decided to make it sound amazing.
No,
or wittier.
Okay, so I'm here with Shane Neville, Jesse Turner, and Nick Wanders, who are the development team behind Shellraiser, a new game, relatively new game on iOS. And we're going to talk about how they made the game, how they feel about the game now, and why they're all raging alcoholics. So, I guess, like, what were your guys' roles in the project? Like, I think, Shane, you were doing design, and Jesse's doing art, and Nick was doing code. Is that
roughly
correct?
Yes.
Yeah, like,
roughly.
That might be the official terms, but... Jen Lewis did audio as well, but I think everyone did design.
Okay.
I just implemented it. You know, the
you
core
did all
idea.
The tuning, for sure.
Yeah, I did all the tuning and level building, but everyone played a big role on the design side.
So I actually got to visit the office of Slick Entertainment, Nick's company, and I guess Jesse, do you own part of the company? Or
No, I'm actually just on salary.
Okay.
With Slick, but I'm not concerned. I'm happy with the way the game turned out.
Are you willing to give half of your stocks to Jesse?
Half?
Yes. Is a.
Ooh, I don't know.
but I was visiting your office with Matt Thorson and Noel Berry like a month ago or something like that, and it was kind of cool watching you guys work because Nick has this like insane, custom made engine that's like. Honestly seems way more powerful than it needs to be for the type of game that you're making. And then watching Jesse work, he's just like painting stuff on a Cintiq, I think, like super fast. It was pretty cool. And I guess I'm curious, like, how did the tool chain sort of play into the design and the tuning of the game? Because
it's actually interesting that you're saying like the engine looks way more powerful than it needs to be, because it probably is.
it was made
for N+ in the beginning, and then I rewrote parts of it, and then it became Scrap Metal, which is a 3D game, and then it was back to 2D when Jesse joined. So, yeah. I guess I had a lot of the stuff ready before we started. Like, a lot of the editor stuff was almost implemented, and then I only had to do a few specific things for, like, actually making levels and actually making objects. Right?
Yeah,
pretty much.
And then we built in, like, coming into the project, I knew Nick was really fast. I knew Jesse was really fast, so I knew I needed fast tools to keep up. So I figured out a quick way that we could make sweeping changes to the game in terms of balance by grouping things and using difficulty groups as a way to build out the levels. And the levels are actually all procedurally generated based on groups, and everyone thinks they're hand-scripted, but they're all procedural.
Okay.
If we said, hey...
They're hand-scripted procedural.
We should actually...
Hand-scripted procedural.
Before we go too far, we should describe what the game is in case people haven't played it.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So it's basically, I mean, the rough idea is that it's a turtle walking from to the right and of your screen, and he just walks along this path of just goblins running at him, and you shoot at them with the guns that are on the turtle's back. Basically.
Yeah, it's like a shooter mixed with a role-playing game. So the shooter side is you've got your turtle and your guns and you're shooting stuff, but then you collect coins to level up and buy new equipment and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you kill anything, even if it's like a hay bale, coins fly at you.
Yeah. Somehow
coins come out of everything.
So then how procedural versus scripted are the levels exactly? Like, where is the divide? What are you sort of controlling as a level designer?
So,
The ground is all hand.
Yeah, the ground's the level of elevation. That's all hand done. But then from that point on, what I'll have is I'll have an X coordinate, and I'll choose what difficulty of a group can go there, or else I can hand place a specific unit. So if I say I want a giant pterodactyl boss here, I can hand place that unit there. Or if I say I want a group that is a difficulty between 8 and 12 to appear here, when the level gets generated, it'll go through and it'll look at all the procedural sections and just place them at that X coordinate. So
we'll have multiple groups of one difficulty level, and you'll just select one.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And so what I did is there's got to be over 100 groups in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Like 200, probably. And I built all these groups, so they might have 3 or 4 different units in them, or else they might be 2 really powerful units. And then I assigned them a difficulty setting, and then I would place them. And then the other thing you can do to make the game, you know, otherwise it would just be like this boring wall, so I would change the spacing a lot. So let's say you're in the game, you're at difficulty level 3, I would take a bunch of guys from difficulty level 2, but place them really tightly packed, so it was hard to shoot them at the same time, and that's difficulty level 3 is like the same kind of gameplay challenge. And so I would do a lot of spacing direct placement, but then within the groups, you know, it was very procedural at that point. The really cool thing is, you know, towards the end of the game, we're like, you know what, we need to give out a little bit more money. And all I had to do was go in and make a couple of quick changes, and you can make these huge sweeping changes through the game. So, you know, it's got 52 levels, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Like a ton of levels, but it's really easy for me to go in and make sweeping changes across 8 levels by just changing 2 groups. So the tools scaled up really quickly.
And how did the original concept of the game come about? I'm looking at Jesse.
I swear, I made sure, because I actually had this showcase idea for a while. I think I remembered it off a variation on a band poster or something. But I was at a bar with Nick, and we just started kind of throwing ideas around together. And I had this pitch for it, and I wanted to make sure we were both straight. Like, we weren't hammered or anything, because everybody's ideas are great. Everybody's ideas are so good.
Yeah.
Everybody loves everybody's ideas when everybody's loose, right? So I pitched this, and it was initially really rudimentary, because I haven't experimented or even used touch things. Yeah, thank you. Touch devices at all. And I'm kind of showing Nick, and initially it was going to be really simple. It was like a turtle with like really, really rudimentary speed controls. One gun on his back, and like, yeah, you just hit him in the face and he slows down, you hit him in the butt and he'll run faster, and you hit him in the guns, it shoots your guns, and he just like does that, how about that? And Nick was like, well, that sounds pretty cool. Let's just do that. So that's basically how it started. Then I found me and Nick prototyped it up pretty quick, and we very, very, very quickly found out, we're like, well, we can't really tune any of this or make any levels. So
many of my games have been like that.
Yeah, which is awesome, because that's, of course, when Shane came on. And Shane made our game bigger by a lot of the decisions he made. And like, we're like, wow, this is going to be a lot simpler. But Shane's like, no, let's add this and this and this. And it's all the better for it.
In the beginning, we were thinking we were going to make this game in 2 months.
Yeah.
and then Shane came on.
Still, like 6 months is still pretty quick.
No, actually,
yeah, outload, right?
Yeah. Like, and then first we were like 2 months, and then Shane had some cool ideas, and we're like, okay, that may be 3 months, and then it turned out to be 6 months, which is still pretty damn quick.
Yeah, it was super quick, and so the game was done at, you know, 3.5-4 months, and it was just a lot of polish. You know, we kind of found the hard thing about the game itself was finding the fun, because nobody else has done a multi-touch, multi-gun control role-playing game before, so we couldn't say, well, in game X they did it like this. So like the role-playing and the leveling, that was super simple. You know, that's been done a bazillion times before, and you know, you just grab a Dungeons and Dragons player's handbook and you've got, you know, your template for how to multiply things up and ramp it all up. But for the shooting and interface, nobody had ever done it before, and that was the hardest part. And I remember we'd be sitting there, and Nick would be like, Shane, game's not fun. And I'm like, yep, that's okay. We're getting closer. Every day we're getting closer. And I remember the night, it was Graham Jans had given me some really good feedback when we were playing the game one night, and I went in after Graham went home and like built a whole bunch of stuff from the tools and sent the game off to Nick, and I was like, I think the game's fun. And that was a really key turning point for us.
So what was the sort of crux of that? What was the sort of realization then?
Blowing up more things faster.
Actually, you reduce the health in a lot of the cannon fodder. Cannon fodder is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then cannon fodder mixed with like hard enemies.
Yeah, and then once we got that basic thing, so the first game, like the first thing was just dudes coming across on the ground and you just point the gun at them and shoot. And so you were managing 2 guns, and that wasn't that exciting because you weren't moving. Mm-hmm. And then I said, hey, what if you go balloon to ground, that up and down was a little bit more exciting because you didn't know where they were going to come next, and then you had to manage the resources and the cooldown times of all the weapons. And then we figured out to just make a ton of guys and really get into this crazy fodder so they come in waves. So you would like be pushing... I'm using my hands on a podcast. Wonderful. pushing from the right hand of the screen closer to the turtle. And as enemies got closer to the turtle, the tension built because they were going to be shooting at you more and doing more damage to you. And so we got this pacing up. We got the fodder in. And then the next big thing was getting the kamikaze units in.
Oh, that was nice.
And putting in the dude with the wheelbarrow with explosives and the buzzard with explosives that just fly right into you. Because then when you're playing, you're mostly on the right side of the screen, but then a kamikaze guy comes in, and you just focus all your energy on them, because if they hit you, they do damage to all your weapons. And then we really started, then we got bosses in. And
treasure chests.
Treasure chests in. Yeah. You know, we just kept adding these mechanics. Like, the original treasure chests were tapped to get the money.
Yeah.
And it's like, what if we shoot them to get the money? Oh, yeah, our game's about shooting, isn't it? Yeah, let's do that.
And
so we just...
And then we made them really tough, and then it actually became a really interesting choice of, like, do you want to shoot the treasure chest to get coins, or do you want to shoot the enemies that are coming at you?
Yeah, like, it's a conscious decision of risk, of I'm going for the money, and that means that I'm focusing all of my energy on getting that money.
What happens if you don't shoot a chest? Is the
just goes by
just trample?
Just go, yeah, just goes right by and you don't get the money.
It's kind of funny, you just, like, destroy it.
Yeah. And all the money goes away, goes off and becomes goblins that attack you. But, you know, it was a constant learning curve, because there was just no other template, and that was the best part, because that was all these discussions we had had. We were like, hey, treasure chest, cool idea. Okay, well, how can we make them better and better and better and better?
Or some of these ideas were just like, hey, we should probably do that, and this was like sent out at night, and then Jesse would come in on the train in the morning, and he would read his email and go, oh yeah, and he would draw some stuff. And then I was like walking to work and like reading the emails, and I'm like, oh, this would be really cool. And by the time I was at work, he would already have something done. Oh, nice. It'd be in before 12. Oh, and then I was like, hey, Shane, here's a new test flight build.
Yeah, and I'd get the tools, and I'd balance it up, add all the experience levels and everything, and by the end of the day, we'd have a new...
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was
the kamikaze units went in really quick, like 2 days.
Kamikaze was fast, Blade the Shredder was super fast.
Yeah.
A lot of the towers, the later towers, came in really fast.
Yeah, because then we had all the tools in place, like fully in place as well.
Yeah.
Because, Jesse, you actually had to learn most of the sprite animation tools first, right?
Which is funny, because I've never been an animator at all.
You're actually really good at it.
I'm already at it, but that was the biggest hurdle for me, because I was used to traditional, like, keyframes, like, and I'm terrible at that, so I had this, like, oh boy, we have a lot of enemies, and I gotta make them all look good like this, and it was a big problem, but when Nick showed me, like, no, it's just like puppets, just slide puppets around, and I ended up getting really familiar with that style of doing it, and... I found Nick's Engine really easy to work with. Like, I know I can't apply that being good at Nick's Engine to anything else I ever do ever again, but it was definitely like the most fun I've ever had building something. And I actually think that shows in the game, art wise anyways, at least. I think it looks like I have this big thing, if the guy who did the art didn't have fun, you can actually physically tell. You can tell in
I think you can tell with design and, in some cases, code as well, if you're paying attention, you know.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, personally, I think that it does, the game kind of shows that I had a great time doing it, because I did have a great time doing it.
Because, well, I mean, in some ways, the more fun you're having, the more willing you're going to be to add more to the game, add more detail to it, and explore those ideas further, you know. If you hate the ideas, then you're probably...
It's impossible to hate. The ideas are really wacky and very, like... how I draw anything and everything anyways. It was like, oh, we need a treasure chest. Well, this is how Jesse draws a treasure chest. And there's no back and forth, there's no revision.
I was just thinking about that. That's actually a true point, because there's only been a few projects that I've worked on where it felt like you caught the wave, you know?
Right.
Like, yeah, like for the wave, and then, now you're on it. And now just cool shit goes into the game so quick, and stuff comes up, and it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if... And before you can say yes, it's already
happened. Yeah, it's so nice when that happens.
Yeah, and that makes the game development really fun. And it also makes the game fun, because it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah, that's how you know you're on the right track, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was, because like the hierarchy was really flat, there was no approvals.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I would just send off a build and be like, guys, I did a whole bunch of cool shit in this new build. Check it out. And it'd be like, that's so cool. And nobody knew it was coming in. And then, like, I'd get a build. It's like, we add some new guys in. It's like, what? That guy's awesome. Yeah. I'll get him in there.
And that's the benefit of when the team feels empowered.
Yeah.
That they'll actually go and just contribute their own stuff, and they won't be waiting for someone to validate their ideas.
Yes, I think, was the biggest word we used on the project. Like, there was very little no on the whole project, and, you know, coming from traditional games, I'm used to a lot of no, and so it was really nice to just, should we do this? Yes. You know, because it was so fast. It was so easy to, it was way easier to do the wrong thing and chuck it out than to spend time arguing about whether or not it was the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, nothing was pitched. And
we actually cut quite a few things.
Oh, we cut a ton of stuff.
We put it in first, and then we said, no.
Yeah, it was actually functional. It was a part of the game for the longest time. We're like, it's not good.
These are really broken.
Yeah. Like the war wagon. The war wagon was one of the first enemies, and it just never worked. Yeah. They tried and tried and tried and made this big giant, like it was a lizard guy with a wagon that would shoot
sounds
mortars at you.
Stuff. It sounds cool.
It sounds really cool. Sure. And it looks
and
awesome.
Actually, the cool thing was that the bullets were really big and they would go really slow, but they would blink.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like a really high-powered bullet that was took a while to kill.
Yeah.
It sounded really cool, but it just totally didn't
work. And we tried so many different iterations.
And then also with Box 2D, there was a few weirdness things where you could hit a shell like right under his wheel and he would flip the whole thing over.
And it's like
the turtle would be in, or the lizard would be on his back with his legs in the air.
Like,
it was so sad to watch. It's just so sad.
It probably fixed that, but we kicked the whole unit out, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
What's fun is I do a lot of like traditional drawing on the SkyTrain, and my art is very throwaway. I consider it throwaway because I like literally threw my art away for the longest time. So when we actually worked really hard and built something, there was no hesitation of like just junk it. And I'm like, of course, just junk it, and we'll build it again because that's like what I've been doing my entire life.
It's like the pterodactyls, because we had pterodactyls were one of the early enemies, and they really I felt they sucked, and I finally figured out a lot of Nick's tuning in the tools, and so one day I was like, I'm going to fix the pterodactyl. So I fixed the pterodactyl and made him really fun to fight and put him back in, and Jesse was like, oh god, that's ugly. I got to redo the whole pterodactyl. So I did and reanimated it, and then it became this really cool, boss character in the game. But it wasn't in the game for 2.5 months.
Yeah.
There were no pterodactyls in it. And
this is sad. This was tragedy. That no pterodactyls. What I found is when we started adding, it sounds like the classic game stuff, like a little Mario Kart meter on how far your turtles go, or a kamikaze guy that just flies into you. Like, literally people...
Combos.
Combos. Yeah. Like, we literally just added all these classes. It's like, well, why reinvent the wheel? Like, it's fun. People know what's going on, and it was a lot of fun to see that actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to come up with the most unique approach to everything. You can just have a neat game and stick
to it. A unique sort of core concept, but then you can still use...
Yeah,
old ideas, but they're going to be reinvigorated in a way where they're playing this different type of
game. And they just fit in so well. Like, they just, it's like, what? Where was this before? This should have been our game the whole time.
Yeah.
I worked on a relationship management game a few years ago, and I wanted to have friendship combos in the game, and it never made it in.
When
Nick was like, do you want a combo system? I'm like, yes. 100% I want a combo system. I need a combo system. I had all these ideas for things to do, all because I wanted it to just say friendship combo on the screen.
So, like, it's kind of an interesting time in Vancouver for the game industry, right? Because, like, a couple months ago, whenever it was, a number of companies started shutting down or downsizing.
It seems like every month.
And it's still going on. Yeah, it hasn't stopped. We're taking huge hits in Vancouver.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but it's all mainstream companies.
It's big guts, yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess I'm curious, like, how are you guys doing with this title since you're indie?
I just acknowledge what I feel like is happening is like the asteroids are hitting a bunch of big dinosaurs and we are these burrowing mammals that just dug in. We're waiting till like everything kind of blows over and we'll like peek back up and pick up some scraps. But like us being this small, like we're okay in my opinion anyways. Nick is a lot more involved on how we are doing. But
business wise, we're fine.
Yeah.
It's actually interesting because when I left Relic in 2007. A lot of people were like, oh, you're starting your own company, that's really risky. And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. But it's scary more than risky. And once you figure out, oh, there's nothing really to be scared about as much, you just make sure you make something that makes some money, because that's the scary part. But once you're there, it's actually a lot less risky, as it turns out, to be an indie than it is to be in a mainstream business.
Well, you know when the end's coming.
For me, you have a lot more insight in it.
Yeah, for me, 2012 was, I didn't ship any games in 2011 as an indie, and so I was like, okay, 2012, got to get some games done, and I got to collaborate more, and I've just got to get some games out there, because if I didn't make any money in 2012, that was it. I had to go back and work and get a job again. And, but I knew that. I knew that where the deadline was. And, I've been at the studios when the layoffs happen.
Yeah, you have no idea.
And you have no idea. Boom. Nobody knows. And I've been the guy who knew as well.
That's even worse.
When we were out with DEI. Knowing that, a studio of 200 people is cutting down to 100. And that friends and knowing that, days or weeks in advance is terrible. It's a terrible thing. And... when you've got your own business, you know what your cash flow is like, you know where the clock is, and that gives me way more confidence than any desk job could.
Also, on the other hand, I have to say, like, when I went indie, I cut down my personal spending hard, hard. Because you're actually living off your savings. You don't want to spend any money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm actually currently wearing a t-shirt that is, I think my newest one has holes everywhere, so I should probably get some new clothes and stuff. But
yeah,
it's like
most of my clothes are like game jams.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm paying for them. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like with the money I have, which is made mostly off of sales of Aquaria. It's like I know how much work I put in to get that money. So if that money is ever going to something really frivolous or stupid, it
feels bad.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like some guy just came and handed you, you know, like a bunch of money. It's like, I don't want to actually spend that money.
Yeah, it means a lot more somehow. Yeah.
It's interesting. So, like, how did you guys decide to go indie? Because I guess a couple of you were mainstream. Jesse, were you?
I worked for about three years at Three Wave, but they're gone now, but they... The legacy Three Wave guys were the guys that put CTF into Quake, and it's a huge deal. And a lot of guys actually remember the Three Wave crew, and we used the // as our the clan kind of name, and people could recognize it on Steam. Like, oh, I played so much CTF, and I'm like, sorry, I had nothing to do with that. But I was like literally a 3D guy, a bad 3D guy. I'm terrible. I'm fast at 3D, and I can like caveman my way through it, but it's like it's not very good. And I would always draw every lunch. I draw all the time, and I just nothing really worked. Like they just couldn't use me, I guess, 2D wise, because we're making multiplayer content for existing stuff. So it's not like goofy 2D boy can just walk in and start designing a bunch of crap. Like, and then after that, it closed down. Like it's the whole thing shut down. I think they kept the skeleton crew to like clean up for like a month. But I was let go. I was freelancing. I use that term very loosely because it was like
the word "free" was really key.
Yeah, it was actually snack or famine for a while there. I was so broke for a year, but I love doing it because I got to draw all the time. But I never had to draw my own stuff. If you're freelancing as an artist and you start working on your own stuff, you feel guilty because you're like, oh, I should be really working with clients and trying to get my name out there and all this other stuff. So after that, I met the guys at Nerdcore who saw me drawing, and they actually thought I was playing a video, like a sped up video. But they're like, oh wow, you are that fast at drawing. So when I worked with them making cartoons for about a year, throughout that year I've been going to the Full Indies where I met Nick. So Nick was actually the first guy I ever met at the Full Indie. He's very scary because this tall Dutchman just walks up to you and starts shaking your hand. But and eventually he's like, dude, just come work for me. And it was like a no brainer. Everybody's kind of worried about, oh, this, what a leap. Wow, go get him, Jess. But, like, literally, it was the easiest decision I have ever made in my life. It was. It was just, like, basically, Jesse, you get to draw what you want all day. You're going to make a fun game.
Yeah.
And, like, Nick actually likes my art, which is, like, great, because that means Nick's not going to say, like, well, Jesse, redraw this, because I have so many stories, like, revisions and... guys and like
was it sort of the thing where people were trying to fit you into a specific style that really was not what you wanted to
that's
do.
Exactly it and okay. The way I draw is like it's fast, but it's gonna look a certain way, and everybody now the big thing is that speed painterly stuff, and when I saw that getting big, I was like, boy, I can't even come close to doing that. So it was like super scary for me, but I love where I am now, and I can't even think about myself doing anything else. It's just,
that's a good story. I guess, Shane, you were also doing mainstream development for...
Yeah, I did mainstream for... Well, I started mainstream games 15 years ago, and I started off at QA at Electronic Arts, testing games, and...
Is that in Vancouver?
Yeah, in Vancouver. So, how I got into the industry is an even longer story. I graduated in 1992, and I lived in a warehouse with a bunch of BMXers and skateboarders, and wasted all my money in like 6 months. So then I moved out to Vancouver, where my sister was the receptionist at Electronic Arts, and it was
okay.
And so she knew the guys that were the head of the QA department, and this was like in like the early days of Electronic Arts Canada. I think it might have still been Distinctive Software back then. And they were finaling the first NHL PC, and they needed additional testers. And I hate hockey. I'm like the guy from Saskatchewan that hates hockey, that's me. And but they didn't have testing stations. So I would come in and work the night shift when the programmers were away, and I would test on the programmers' computers until they came in the morning. So that was like my first job, and that was in 93, 92. And then after I went back to university, and after university I said, hey, I've got this huge student loan to pay off, and I know I can get a lot of overtime working QA at EA. And I also managed to get a lot of stocks working a lot of overtime. So I did QA for a year, then I moved on to the Need for Speed team to be a writer.
Okay, so just a sec. What's it like being on a QA team? Like, because I've heard stories.
I had already registered to go back to university, but in hindsight, I really enjoyed it. Did you want to?
No, I need to get my laundry.
Okay.
Nick needs to go get his laundry.
I'll be right back.
He'll be back. stay tuned.
I was one of the only guys, I think, that liked QA. Like, the downside of QA is you're playing the same game all the time, and I'm not a sports guy. So I was really lucky I got on the Need for Speed team, because if I got on the FIFA team or the NHL team or any other team at Electronic Arts Canada, I would have been screwed. Besides, like, not being into sports, you know, three of the best friends of my entire life I made in QA. And, you know, we had a really good time. There was a ton of overtime back then, so you would do just crazy stuff. There was a guy that we worked with that he had a can of a whole chicken on his desk, and it just sat there for years. The guy had been in QA, and this can of chicken was this thing. And one guy said, you know what? Another guy said, let's raise some money. If you guys raise $100, I'll eat that can of chicken. Whole can chicken. God. And so, you know, they rallied the crew, and we started having all these weird gluttony challenges and all this. It was goofy times. And mm-hmm. still to this day, when I go down to GDC or E3 or any of the conventions, and I see people from that era in QA, you know, it's we got really tight, and a lot of us are still in the industry and still doing different things. You know, like John Dowswell was the general manager at Relic, and he worked in QA way back then, and a lot of guys have gone on to do different things, and so I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't trade it for the world, simply because it taught me how to find flaws in games and to be really, really critical on quality in games. And that was, as a producer, which is where my career ultimately ended up going, it was the one thing. Because you ship, you know, 8 games a year. So you can look at the bug database, play the game for an hour, and you know how much time is left before it's done. Hmm. And it's just a gut check. And you can't get that. When you're a producer and you ship one game every 2 years, your gut sucks. You don't know where things are at. You're too close to the project. When you're in QA, you can just, how many bugs are there? There's 50 open bugs. Okay, we got 3 weeks left. You know, it's like, no, we got to be done in 2 weeks. Well, that sucks, because there's 50 bugs, and that means we got 3 weeks left, because you just see it on every single project time after time. And so, you know, there were a lot of late nights, and, you know, I never want to play FIFA Road to World Cup Nintendo 64 again, but I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of the things I'm curious about is the monotony of it. Like, the most monotonous job I have is data entry, and I lasted, like 4 days or something before I had to just quit, because I was having nightmares about it.
Yeah.
But does it make you hate the game, or does it make you, is there kind of like a Stockholm Syndrome thing where you just fall in love with it because you're so intimately acquainted with it?
I was there for a year in the QA department, and the first 3 months, 4 months was really bad. Like, it was just, I was getting all the crappy gigs, and then when I got onto the FIFA team, I was one of the early guys on the team, and I was put in charge of gameplay. So everyone else was, like, checking stats and jersey colors, and I was making sure there were no gameplay bugs. So I just got to, you know, do all the deeks and the special moves and get really good at playing the game, and then we would, you know, have tournaments from the gameplay people on all the other teams, because I was on the Nintendo team, there's a Saturn team and a PlayStation team and a PC team. So we just got really good at playing the game. So I just literally played for fun and tried to break the gameplay every day. So that was really great. When I was on the Need for Speed team for Need for Speed Hot Pursuit, that was the first one with cops. I was the cop guy. So I had to,
you did a good job.
I had to email, you know, the producer and say, hey, this cop comes out too fast, this cop comes out too slow, he's being a little aggressive. I was just doing gameplay feedback and gameplay testing, where other guys were like, you know, I'm in charge of weather. So I've got to make sure weather works on every single track. So they start off at the beginning of the day, and they load up track one, day, rain, night, rain, and just go through their grid and just check off all these things. And then in all the game modes, too. And, you know, so I got really lucky that I got put in those positions. And so I know some people. Jersey checking in sports games is the worst job in the world, and I wouldn't wish that job on anyone.
Right. Yeah.
Because you know, if you don't know it, you have to find out what the right color for this country was at World Cup, and where do you find that information in 1995? The internet's barely has that information on it, right? So you're digging through books and it was so painful. And you know,
trips to the library.
And, you know, some star player dyes his hair bleach blonde, you know, right before the game comes out. You got to catch that bug. You're the guy in charge of making sure that gets done. So
throwing.
It was not. I got off lucky, and I know I got off lucky. There were other people that had much more difficult jobs, like front end testing, where you're just in the menus all day, and that's where all the bugs are.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you want to break a game, just go in the menus. You know, I can take any EA game, any sports game, I can break it in a couple hours. I can go in the menus and break stuff. I broke NHL, or no, NBA 2010, or 20, it was 2010. I broke that, I think, in the first hour of playing, and just playing, because I knew, I was like, you know what, I wonder, oh, there, it's frozen. Yeah, still got the touch.
Interesting. So, I wonder what kind of bugs are going to their front end in that case. It's just like menu items that don't link to.
Yeah, and there's just, and there's so much legacy. You know, I was talking.
Oh, with, right, because I remember hearing that the goalie code in NHL has been the same since 90 something.
Yeah.
That sounds like really stable.
Yeah,
I just keep that around.
I was talking to one of the producers on NBA like back in like 2007, 2008, and they were getting ready for E3, and there was this crash, and they couldn't figure it out, and then they narrowed it down to this crazy, messy hack, and the comment said, crazy, messy hack. For E3 1999,
yeah.
Do not remove. And so 9 years later, the same messy hack is now breaking the game. And they're like, what are we doing in there? I don't know. Let's figure it out. And so they were all paranoid of it. So that's a big problem with anything that's going on an annual basis, right? You got all this legacy bugs, legacy codes.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But, you know, it's EA's QA department was always amazing. Like, you could. And you can still see it today. Like, if you play games from, you know, Ubisoft, Bethesda, you know, Activision, I think, has a pretty good QA department, too. But out of the big publishers, EA's QA department is still, they're pretty good.
So, somehow you made the leap from QA to writing.
Yeah.
How the hell do you do that?
So, anytime, and it was easier to move out of QA back in the day than it is now, I think. But anytime that a position came up, it was, the head of the QA department would identify people that they thought would be good for it, and they would let you know and say, hey, are you interested? Oh. So I was basically in a contest with four other guys to go in and do the speech writing for the cops in high stakes, where the cops would actually say, I'm in pursuit of a red Porsche, you know, outside of the so-and-so tunnel. And, you know, code 43, I'm in pursuit, all that stuff. And I got in this competition with them. I wrote a bunch of scripts, did a bunch of research, and got the job. And the cool thing was, is the guy who was supposed to do it, he was an associate producer going on a sabbatical. So I moved onto the team into his office, which was like this big, huge, beautiful office with a corner view. And,
sounds
lifeful.
Which was awesome. Yeah. And then he came back from the sabbatical. And
then he showed up with a bag full of money.
Yeah, exactly. Here, this is you. It's your brother's check. And then, you know, he came back from the sabbatical, and I was sitting at this tiny little desk outside of another person's office, just looking in on her while she was working. And I'm like, hi, I'm just working out here. So it was like from this grand office to, you know, basically a doorstop in the hallway. And then that led on to an assistant producer position on the Need for Speed team, which was a lot more designy than writery, and I stayed on the team.
So how much creative flexibility or expression do you get when you're writing dialogue for cops?
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like, well, like, what's an example of something that you would have written that would have been sort of out, that would have been maybe like you and not, somebody else wouldn't have written that?
Well, we got to use British accents for some of the tracks, so we got to call people toe rags and things like that, like, and dig up some of those weird Britishisms. But for me, the really cool thing was, is this was in the cutting edge of speech stitching. So Jen Lewis, who did the audio on Shellraiser, she was also doing the audio way back then. So that's why I first started working with Jen. And so, you know, you don't write the script of, I'm in pursuit of a red Porsche, da-da-da-da-da. You write, I'm in pursuit of a red Porsche. And you, so you can stitch it all together and then have it go seamlessly. And so for me, that was the cool part, was like learning this new system, writing a script non-linearly, basically. And
so
then
almost
going,
more like a design thing than a purely writing thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I got to talk to cops. You know, I'd be like, hey, I work at Electronic Arts. Do you want a copy of NHL? And we'll sit down and drink some beers, and you can tell me all about how cops talk to each other. And you learn things like, you know, people, you know, 411 is the code for marijuana. But that's only in one district in some place in the States. Every other cop group, every other police station has their own code for marijuana or drugs or break and enter or murder. You know, 187 is not the universal murder code for the world, you know. It's so you learn those little things that, you know, the code numbers don't matter. So we just got to, I got to make random numbers.
Oh, nice.
So a few fun things like that. So that was the coolest thing, was talking to the cops and then getting in with the speech talent and seeing these guys that have incredible voices.
Yep.
And would go off and do these crazy things.
I love voice actors.
Oh, yeah.
I find that whole thing really
cool. It is amazing. When I went to the cartoon place, they have tons of auditions, and I would just troll through all these auditions, and I'm like, man, these people sound amazing. Like, they sound so good. I'm like, I would talk like that. I would use that amazing villain voice for everything. I would go shopping, and I would yell that all at everything. Oh,
plastic bags.
Exactly.
Pineapples are half off.
it just, I'm jealous because I've always loved cartoons and everything, but these guys that can just, just belt it out.
Yeah, like, they can create so many different characters, and they're, and it's interesting to watch them do it too, because there's so much physicality to it that you don't know when you're just listening to it, but you can just see that they're trying to totally get their whole body into the role, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
Also, it's not like it's a filter, right? It's like, if you see a celebrity, you're like, ooh, that's
mm-hmm.
Ryan Reynolds or whoever it is. But if the guy behind you is Billy West and he all of a sudden does the Fry voice, you're like, what? Like, you just light up. You're like, oh.
Did you see the video of the guys that were doing, it was a panel of voice actors, and they were reading Star Wars. But in different voices, so it's like, you do Darth Vader as Bender. Okay. And so we read all Darth Vader's lines as Bender, and it was the most ridiculously funny thing I've seen in a long time.
And
like, it's the first internet video over an hour long that I actually watched on YouTube for more than an hour while sitting at my desk working.
Tell them about how spontaneous they are, too. How quick they are to react to everything. It's just, it's like watching an absolute master. They just figured it out.
So, Nick, how did you end up transitioning from mainstream to indie?
So, I worked... Well, I might as well start at the beginning. I basically started working at...
You were born in a log cabin that you helped build.
What's that?
You were born in a log cabin that you helped build.
Yeah. I basically worked in Holland. I grew up in Holland, so I worked there at a company called Lost Boys Games, which now turned into... got bought by Sony and turned into Guerrilla Games, the guys that do Killzone. I didn't work on Killzone, by the way, but... and I applied at Relic at one point because I wanted to leave, and they hired me. I was like, oh, sweet. So I worked there for 5 years, and then I've always had the idea of, okay, maybe one day I want to start my own company. And another guy that worked at Relic was Jamie Chang, who now owns Clay Entertainment.
Yes.
So he was actually an intern. I think he was an intern on Homeworld 2 to do the AI. And then later he worked there as well, I think. I can't quite remember. It's such a long
time. That sounds alright.
Yeah. And then at one point he quit and started his own company called Clay Entertainment. About a year after that, he called me and was like, hey, so I got these guys in Toronto, and they have this game called N. Do you know it? And I was like, yeah, I know N. It's like this super cool ninja game browser game. I was like, sweet. And he's like, yeah, they want to put it on XBLA, but they don't really know how. But you've done, you know, I had done an Xbox 360 game at that time. And he's like, well, what, you know, and you want to start your own company. Why don't you do that now? And I was like, thinking about it for like a day. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. And I had saved up a bit. So, you know, with the idea of maybe one day I'll do my own thing. And it just kind of came along and I just jumped into it, basically. And N Plus turned out really well, did really well, so that basically funded Scrap Metal that we did after that. And, it's been going ever since, you know? 2007 is when I quit, since 2012 now, so 5 years now.
That's actually really intimidating for me, because I am, like, new kid on the block, and these guys have been in this biz for so long. And, like, I don't know, it's a little bit weird, because, like, yeah, Jen worked on this game with me way, way back in the day, and we've been pals for absolutely ever, and I'm, like, literally out of nowhere. I feel totally lost in the whole thing.
I think you're handling yourself just fine.
I think Jesse likes to criticize himself. Sounds so short.
I think Jesse is the artist with the, like, I probably hired him just because he has the biggest minority complex on the planet. It's like, oh, I'm such a bad artist. Yeah, sure you are.
Yeah,
just start this.
I just people say, wow, you're doing really good and stuff. Like, seriously, if you saw me 3 years ago, I was a lot lighter for the battery, for bad reasons. So I was broke as hell, and I could not find work. I was begging for work. Mm-hmm. And it feels good, because I do feel kind of like, okay, this was worth doing. Because I've actually, mm-hmm. Some people said, this isn't marketable. What you do isn't marketable. You need to focus more on 3D, which I know some amazing 2D guys that are amazing 3D guys, and I'm super jealous and awesome, but I'm like, I literally like, okay, I can't do that. I can do my thing.
I think if you have any particular skill, it is marketable. It's just a question of
you gotta find someone that wants it.
The person who told you it wasn't marketable in their domain.
I was gonna say, guess what? The entire iPhone market wants it. That's not bad.
That was also really helpful, because Nick, being around people that have been here for so long, like, when Shane's like, hey, our game's fun, you actually believe it.
Yeah, you actually, yeah.
And that's not like, he's not like my pal that we pal around and he loves everything I do. We're just like, he literally says, our game isn't fun, then our game is fun. And Nick says, I feel confident about this. The amount of backing that gets is just huge. You're like, okay.
That's a huge thing that I've noticed, you know, collaborating with different people. That, like, the people collaborating with are the ones who are going to be very honest.
Yeah.
And you actually believe,
believe
that they have something, they can see something, you know, and they can tell the quality of something, they can see the potential for it or the lack of potential for it.
And Shane, a bunch of ideas we brought up, Shane's like, that's not going to work. And you know that it's probably not going to work, so we should stop wasting our time and do something else. And that happening is just great, because it's not, let's just dick around for 2 weeks.
A lot of projects go that way. This sounds cool, let's try it. Oh crap, it didn't work. You know, but then because you, in that particular project, you don't have that sense of, we know where this is going, or, you know.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the conversations we had, it would be like, here's an idea. And I'd say, well, what about this? And what about this? And it was, I would only come down to the Slick office once every week or two. But every single time, our chairs were facing towards each other for most of the day that I was in there, because we were just throwing ideas around. And
we were always planning to do work, and then it ended.
There was just no work.
We should have actually recorded those things as a fun thing.
But it was a lot of, you know, what about this idea? Well, this sucks about it. And we would just hash it out, and it wasn't, because it's such a flat reporting structure, and then nobody could pull rank, you know, it was like, mm-hmm. Let's do it or not. And if we were all on board, like, the treasure chest is a perfect example of something that nobody was really excited about. We all thought, should we put them in? Can we? Is it worth it? What's the reward for the player? Is it going to be fun? And then as soon as, like, what if we shot them? Why would you shoot them instead of touching them? It's a touch screen. It's like, because it's a shooting game.
Yeah.
And then they could have different health, and we could have bigger chests that had more health, and suddenly it was just like, we really got behind it. And then a day later, the chests were in the game, and they were awesome.
Yeah. Like, it was basically, everyone was so confident in everyone else's abilities that it's like, I'm gonna draw this enemy. He's gonna be whacking this, and it's gonna be smart and easy to build because Nick coded it, and then it's gonna be fun and easy to deal with because Shane's on it. Like, yeah, Jesse's on it. Yeah, Nick's on it. Yeah, Shane's on it. Like, it literally was this.
No, I love when that actually works that way. Yeah, there's been lots of projects where it's been like, okay, you're gonna handle this. All right, sweet. And then it's like, nope, they didn't handle it. Okay, all right.
I actually find too that just because I love working in super tiny teams, I like working in big teams as well. I mean, I've met a ton of really talented and cool people to work with at Relic and at Guerrilla Games, but the one thing that you get in large teams is communication problems. You know, everybody can be on board, but everybody's still running in a slightly different direction, and then suddenly 2 weeks later everybody looks at each other and goes, where the hell did you go? Why are we doing this now? Well, because this guy said this, and in a small team you just don't get that.
I remember
it was very clear where we were going, what we were doing.
That's right. I actually remember when Nick said, okay, I'm gonna get Shane on. Great, that sounds awesome. He's like, you do understand that's like, what, quadrupling the amount of
communication lines.
And I actually stopped and thought, like, holy crap, it is, because there's Nick's.
Now there's six instead of two.
And it was just this huge realization.
But, and then you add another person, and now it's
so much more.
I think it was great about the time that Jen joined the team that we really started using Pivotal Tracker a lot more, and started, you know, like, anytime I was at my desk, Skype was open, and there was a lot of communication going through, but just using simple as Pivotal Tracker really streamlined everything, because you knew what everyone else was working on and what was, like, getting held up, and
Yeah, you gotta write it down somehow to get to remember it, because stuff went so quick that it's easy to forget.
You'd play the game, and you would make a whole bunch of notes, and you'd come in, and you would, like, enter them into Pivotal Tracker, but you would be assigning work to other people, and be like, this animation looks weird. I'm, like, giving Jesse work. It always felt weird, but there was never any backlash. Like, the only thing was, what is the problem, or what if I fixed it like this?
Yeah.
And, you know, same thing, you'd be like, level 8 is way too hard. I'm like,
all
right,
so
cool.
How long have you guys all known each other before working on this, then? Or was it more of just a fortuitous, oh, it happens that we work really well
together? I knew Jesse, well, from the full indie meetups.
Yeah,
that's about it. Maybe that was a year before?
Yeah, it was.
But I just, like, met you once, and then, like half a year later, we said hi again and started talking. And then
I honestly
like
can't really
forth.
Remember what
but
happened.
But only, I think only when... Because I was working with another guy, Case Random, before. Mm-hmm. He did all the 3D art for Scrap Metal, and he did some other art on N Plus as well. And basically in January, actually around September, October last year, he basically said, hey, I want to do something else. I want to go into film and you know, do cool stuff with 3D. And I was like, oh, okay. And so in January we finished it all off, and you know, he took his part of the company and did his own thing. But at that, so basically around that time, I was like really looking for a new artist. So I was like, hey, okay, I met this guy at Full Indie. So that's when we really started talking and really started hanging out and getting drunk, I guess. But
that isn't when I started getting drunk.
No, I just like co-op played it, you know?
Yeah.
And Shane, I actually didn't know you at Relic, because you worked at Relic as well. But
we worked at the same time for about a week. So all that Nick was
the
other tall guy.
I was, like, counting the hours to get out of there.
Yeah.
And he was, like, super excited.
I was like, I'm at Relic. My lifelong dream has come true.
And I was like, I want to get out of here now. So we didn't really know each other. But we met, like, actually, I think it was Jen that actually said, hey, you should talk to Shane. When you went indie, when you quit and did your own thing, multiple people told me, hey, you should talk to Shane.
And then we hung out at the Independent Game Summit at GDC.
Oh, right.
Just a little bit. But that was that was the time, like, the first time we actually talked.
Yeah.
I was like, you look familiar.
Yeah. That was actually wasn't that even before the Full Indie stuff?
Yeah, that was before Full Indie. But we didn't really talk too much until Full Indie.
I just remember, like, talking at the IGS to people, where it's like, man, this IGS feeling is the shit.
Yeah.
It is awesome.
Yeah.
Right? And I wish, you know, and then you talk to all the Toronto guys, and they have this tight-knit group of indie people, and I'm like, man, I wish we had that. And then literally half a year later, Jake Burkett comes to town and just starts his indie meetup, and now it's like
huge.
That feeling.
Yeah.
It's
so good.
But, yeah, I guess that's where I first met you, and then...
Yeah. And then Full Indie, we just started hanging out more and more and more.
And then we had the prototype that we showed you.
Yeah.
And then I said, hey, you need to work on this. And
well,
you're like, oh, I'll think about it.
The prototype,
maybe.
The prototype
and
closed.
And the next morning, at 8 a.m., she sent me an email and said, I'm in.
So there was... Because Nick got in touch with me over Christmas of last year, so December of 2011, and said, hey, you want to get together and throw some game ideas around? And, like, the three of us were throwing ideas around,
right.
And nothing was sticking. And then they showed me some of the concept art for Shellraiser, then called Nature of the Beast, and I was like, it looks kind of cool. And then they did the prototype, and the next morning I went home, talked to my wife, said, yeah, I'm in. And that was go time.
Did your wife have any big questions for you?
No, it's...
It's a pretty easy sell.
It's like,
no,
like, okay.
It's a giant turtle.
It's like, oh, I get it. Go, honey.
You're still talking about, hey, you know, I'm going to be doing this project for a while.
I'm not going to be working on my own stuff. I'm going to shut down all my consulting. That was how I was paying the bills at the time, was doing consulting. And it was the gamble. It was getting in the boat, you know, putting both feet in the boat and saying, all right, this is where we're going. Because, you know, when you sign on for a project, and I knew Nick was really good, and I'd met Jesse at a few Full Indies, and all I heard was, Jesse is hella fast, that guy can go. So I thought, if I'm going to work with these guys, I got to bring my A game. And that meant that there's no consulting. You know, I ramped down my teaching at Vancouver Film School and said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to hop in and go for it. And that was the big gamble, because if it didn't pay off, I only had 6 months left in savings before I had to go in and get a job. So
I think one of the things too, though, when you did join, I was excited about is that, because I really found out by doing my own thing what I really don't like doing. And one of those things is actually tuning stuff. I love making systems. Yeah. I hate tuning stuff.
Yeah.
And then when Jesse joined, it was like, he's good at art, which I'm crap at. And I was like, okay, great. And it really kind of became apparent, like, we need a guy who actually loves to tune stuff.
Because it's not us.
It's like, hey, Shane, you like tuning stuff? And I always just said, I love tuning stuff.
Yeah.
And like, then there's little knobs in front of me, and I'm turning them a little bit here and there.
For some strange reason,
I want to work with you now. I don't like tuning stuff either.
Yeah. No, it's a skill. It's something you have to love. And if you do love it, then and you have, like, your own systems of what you want to achieve, then that's really cool. But I, personally, I just can't stand that stuff. I love making the systems to make it happen. I just don't love actually doing it.
Yeah.
So,
well, when we did Porsche Unleashed, there were, I don't know, 86 Porsches in the game, and me and this other guy had to tune all of the physics on all the cars based on stats. So you had like your Porsche book and like what horsepower was, what a 0 to 60 was, and you had to like put it in the game engine, test it to see if the acceleration was right. If it wasn't, go back and tweak it again.
Oh, wow.
I had a blast.
That's so boring.
And now for my life, I'm a nerd. Like, I'm a full-on Porsche nerd. But like,
that's
awesome. For the 3 years after that, I could look at any Porsche and be like, that's a, you know, 84 whale tail or whatever it was. And it was
a really applicable skill. There's a lot of Porsche
companies. It's I don't know. I love it. I love just getting, you know, that's why my first indie game was a platformer. I just wanted to get, like, the numbers right. Playing with jump speed and run speed and acceleration and just seeing how far you can push that.
That's what was really cool, though, was Shane's like, well, we're going to make, like, 50 levels. And me and I go, like, what? Like,
we thought we were doing 20.
Like even less, we're like, 50 levels? You can make 50 levels? Oh, yeah, we can make 50 levels. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, okay, I'm not really stressed out about how many levels are in our game, because Shane said, I can make 50 levels, no problem. Mm-hmm. Like, duh.
Yeah, like, oh. That's because, you know, Nick made the tools the way that I needed them made so I could make 50 levels and do it while keeping my sanity. So,
did you ever at any point feel like I should force myself to learn how to love tuning?
I tried.
Did you feel like it was a deficiency? Or were you just at some point like, I don't care, I'm an awesome programmer, I'm great at this business thing, I don't need to do this.
I think it's a deficiency, but sometimes it's like, I wish I liked it, so that I mean, it's not that I can. I don't feel like I can't do it. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
And like for Scrap Metal, Case and I basically did all the tuning of stuff. I did some of it. He did a lot of it, and I just found out that, it's just a part that I don't like doing it. And if you don't like doing it, it shows.
Oh yeah.
It will show.
Yeah.
And so I found, hey, you know what, maybe if you actually find somebody you actually love doing it, that's so much better. Right?
Hold on to them as long as you can.
Yeah, it's
I remember we were, it was one of the guns, maybe it was the shotgun or something else, and I had totally changed the reload speed and how it fired, and so the animations were getting cut off and the sounds weren't playing, and everyone was like, I gotta redo the sounds, I gotta redo the animations. I was like, is it more fun?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, so we can redo it then, right?
Yeah.
The gun feels better to shoot.
Yeah.
It does.
That's interesting, you know, because I don't think people think about that much when they're first going into game development. I don't think they really realize the importance of tuning. I think they recognize that there's design, but I don't know, at least me when I was a kid, it was a lot of just like, I just need to design the game and then make the game. But then that's like maybe a third of what
design the game, make the game, and make the game work right.
Make the game actually
really tuning is just iterating on design, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is your design, now you have to fine tune it.
And it's a weird, ambiguous feel thing. And again, I think that's all QA for me. Because I spent a year in QA, and for half my year, all I did for 60, 70 hours a week was give people feedback on how the game felt.
Yeah.
You know, was the acceleration right on this player when he was running up the field, or did this car corner properly on the field or on the track? And that was all I did all day, was just give feedback on feel. And so it's like, now I can play a game, but like, this needs to go up 10% faster. You need to give me 20% more money. You know, it's just like, it came into my DNA just because that's all I did for half a year.
And actually seeing that, come together, like, wow, this money curve is amazing, Shane. Like, it's unbelievable to me, because if you put me in a room and said, okay, Jesse, make the money curve right, I just...
Yeah, I can imagine me trying to do this, too. I'd just be like, linear?
You'd probably put some math into it.
I
probably would.
At least you can put math into it.
Yeah.
I guess.
I cheated, though.
What's that?
So have you been to my office?
Yeah.
So like, in the closet, in the back of the closet, there's three shelves of role-playing books.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, three shelves wide of... And I just grabbed a whole bunch of role-playing books that I felt had good level progression curves. And I said, okay, that's how they do that. I'm like, oh, how's the cost work? And I basically found different systems and commonalities between them and used that as my template. And then, of course, tweaked it and bent it. But that was where my first... When I came in and said, okay, all the heavy strokes are in, that's where I got the heavy strokes from.
Because
it's a proven system, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And it's really cool to look through, you know, 4 editions of Dungeons & Dragons and see how they improved the curve and say, why did they do that?
Right.
Oh, I see why they did that. And look at how those designers did it and then adapt.
Wow.
Yeah, those are my cheat sheets. My wife's like, what do you do with those books? Like, I pull them out once a year for something, and then I put them back, but I can't get rid of them. You can't get, like, the first edition Advanced D&D on PDF, you know. You probably can, but you know, it needs to be on the shelf, so I just grab it and check.
What's interesting is I think it's kind of a commonality in all the things. Like, we all have, in all the different disciplines, there's inspiration that you go back to. Like, I'm sure you have art, you know, artists that you inspired by. And,
I luckily, 2007, I think, I got to go to San Diego Comic Con, and I actually met Dan Paladin there.
Oh,
and he's,
nice.
Like, my favorite game artist ever.
Hmm.
Which is, I think it's cool, because, like, there's some amazing game artists out there. But I literally, Dan Paladin is my favorite game artist, because everybody loves his stuff. Like, 6-year-old kids draw Castle Crashers. 30-year-old kids draw Castle Crashers. You know what I mean?
Dressed up as Castle Crashers.
Exactly. Like, and his stuff's just so, like, lovable, and I remember talking to him, and I was, like, gushing, because I'm usually pretty cool around people. I'm totally...
No, you're not.
Okay, I'm really bad around people that I love like crazy. And I was like, so, because he's made Castle Crash, I'm like, well, your favorite game's River City Ransom. So you're like, you're Cloud9, man, this is it. He's like, yeah, I'm having a lot of fun, it's really great. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I was lucky enough, I got in contact with him for a while, and I was doing some talking and stuff, and like, listen, man, like, my stuff isn't sticking. He's like, no, you're good. Like, just keep at it. This is really what he said. Because people told that guy that no one wants a game with your art in it. Don't quote me, Gus, but he told me something to that effect.
Right.
And, like, I've been told the same thing. I'm probably not as mean, because sounded like they were pretty mean to that guy. But, and he just did it anyways. And I'm crazy about that guy's stuff. And there's, like, comics is a big thing. I love comics. I tried doing a comic, and it is the most work I have ever done in my entire life. Like, I was writing and inking and coloring and everything, but I was like, this is so much work. I love comics, and I respect the hell out of anyone that can do a comic, but it really isn't for me.
Mm-hmm. You should try it now. Your comics in the game are pretty good.
Oh,
and you did them really fast.
Yeah, maybe, but it's just way more fun making games. Because I make something, and it's just like, it lives now, and it moves, and it animates.
And
guys that are giving it brains and behaviors that I could never do. That you can't get that from a bunch of still images, but you can get that from a team of, you know, skilled guys or guys and gals. So
It's kind of an interesting thing about games, just like how much use is going to come out of those art assets.
Yeah.
And in a proper game where it's going to be, you know.
Comic, it's like literally flip, glance, 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 read.
Yeah, like I read comics so fast that I feel guilty. I'm like, I know this person spent all this time, but I'm not going to stare at it that long. It's a lovely panel, but I'm excited to read the story.
Yeah.
And it just drives me to go to the
next panel. I always feel bad. I read a ton of comics too, and you get that page where there's a ton of dialogue, and then the next page is like action, and it's only got three things, and you literally just go, okay.
Yeah.
And you go to the next one, and you're like, what did I just miss?
Yeah.
That guy slaved on that. There were no words on that page. That is his page. That's his baby that he was working for, because the writer didn't fill it with word balloons. And I just like, meh, go to the next one.
Yeah, I'm a big like I'm a work smarter, not harder is totally my thing. So there's a point where we need a lot more 2D stuff in the game, and I literally just like went back and pulled old stuff. So they think I'm fast, but I'm really just really hacky and lazy, and I just pull it all in. And that was,
it works though.
Yeah,
it works.
And but, like again, like yeah, everybody really likes the turtle. And for a while there, actually, the game kind of wasn't about the turtle in some way. Like, I don't know.
It was more like the dudes on the back.
Yeah,
But, and the turtle's just kind of...
But I remember, like, Jen really responded to it. She's like, well, this game's all about this turtle. And so, after thinking
how do
that,
people connect to the turtle?
Yeah,
we're
like, what? What?
I don't know.
It was this totally
connect?
New... Yeah.
You know, through the bolts on the back, and then you come, you know, I don't know.
That's what's happening? Also, another great suggestion is, initially it was all hard surface for the cannons, and Nick said, it should just be, like, rickety scaffolding. And that's the best. Like, that makes everything hilarious, because it barely works.
Like, held together by... medieval orc duct tape.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the whole rickety.
Which is good because my art literally has like no rules. There's automatic firearms in a medieval world. Like literally, if you actually pan it out, you're like, this makes no sense. Like this, this universe is bonkers.
It,
like,
it works.
Really
it fits together though. That's the main thing, I guess.
Yeah. I'm a big avatar. Your game doesn't need to look good. It just needs to look consistent.
It doesn't be consistent.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
It.
In its own world.
Yeah. Luckily, and that's what's also awesome when you're the only art guy on the team and you're pretty quick, because literally the game can't look not consistent because there's only one guy doing it. So that I really
you had your processes down too, like his watching him work. It's just like Photoshop action, Photoshop
he
action.
He knows what he's
it's all shortcuts and you know this is the brush I use. It's the only brush I use.
I Scherzer has three brushes that I use. Like that's it, and fills.
I remember that you were trying to make a time-lapse video, and then afterwards, when you actually watched the video, it was horrible because everything is zipped around so quick, you just couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
It's like he zooms in on one part, and then the next frame is like zoomed out to the right, and then it's to the left, and it's like... And then you redid it.
Yeah, I
can't zoom, I can't pan. Just trying to draw. It wasn't as quick, but it looked cool.
I tried to do live stream once, and I actually gave a friend of mine motion sickness, and I felt really bad about that. So I was like, you should totally live stream. I'm like, you guys are just gonna like barf or hate the way I do things. So yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing that's kind of interesting to me when I was playing the game is that because I saw the process of making the game before playing it. And you took me and Noel through all the tools that you built and how crazy they are. Like,
why do you think they're crazy?
Well, because I use Unity.
But is it crazy as in like extensive, or crazy as in like why would you ever make tools like?
No, I mean, I don't know. I usually use crazy as like a positive thing.
Okay,
that's
what
awesome.
I was just wondering.
But to me, it seems something like, you know, that I would never even
spend the time
approach.
Doing them. Right.
I would, and the weird thing is, like, I saw your tools, and you explained how you have, like, one version of the engine in C++ and another in C#, and you have to maintain both.
There were some good bugs that came out of that one.
Really?
Remember when we couldn't figure out why the touch area was so big?
Oh, it didn't work
in the game?
Yeah.
It's like, well, we didn't copy that across. The last
but that doesn't, I have to say, though, that doesn't happen often. Because you're saying like you know like you have to maintain two things, but it's actually the render engine as is doesn't change that much. I barely ever change any of the system stuff. It's only the game code that changes.
Right. So it's at a point where it's relatively stable.
Yeah.
But just from my perspective, like I've gone from the point of like a query where I was writing my own engine, C++, OpenGL stuff to like using Unity and making a mock-up in like a weekend and then throwing it out and you know like that kind of thing and minimizing the amount of you know, stuff that I'm touching in terms of lower level thing, where you're controlling the entire sort of lower level experience, which is really cool. But I just want to go through some of the things that I saw so people know. There's the fact that the engine was duplicated twice, essentially.
Yeah.
There was at least some of it. And there's an editor application that has the skeletal sprite animation system, which is really extensive. And really powerful, and particles that can be and level. It's all in the same editor, which is pretty incredible. And then you had some cool way of getting it onto the iPad. I forget what that was. Was it wireless or something?
You can actually. Well, you can hook up the editor to the iPad. So Shane, for example, worked off site, so or at his own house, basically. So he could like download a test flight build. And then he'd get the tools on Dropbox. And then he would just unpack his tools, run the tools, and then he could connect the tool to the iPad. So whenever he changed his tuning, specifically the tuning, not all the...
Right.
He couldn't change art, because that would all be baked into the iPad version. But he could change the tuning just through a TCP/IP connection, which worked really well, I guess.
Yeah, it was awesome. It saved so much time, because otherwise I would have needed to be able to make my own builds.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I could just be, you know, this gun needs to fire
50% faster.
50% faster, whatever. And I could build it. And then the cool thing is I could sync all the data, and then I could go and lay down on the couch and play for 20 minutes, and then come back with a bunch of notes, and then go in and tune them.
And then at the end of the night, you would just like zip up the data directory, send it to me, and I'd integrate it for the next day build.
Yeah, zipping was very essential, because Dropbox doesn't tell you when everything's synced up, so you could sometimes grab my changes from the folder, and I'd be like, why did those changes get in? Because we supposed to be zipped it.
Yeah.
Fixed all those problems, lickety split.
So, yeah, so on the subject of two engines, though, like, the main difference, why I did that, I was, because you asked me that at that time, and I was kind of like, well, because that's how it works. I actually got to think about it, and the main reason I actually did that is because I've always hated, I've always really liked having an editor that actually runs the game. In the editor. That is, like, vital. The problem is, if you do that, your engine gets so bloated with all the editor bullshit that you need that it just gets...
Gross,
right? So basically, I was like, well, what if I just have the entire engine in C#? Like, and 3D engine or a 2D engine, in essence, isn't huge.
That complicated.
Yeah. The engine we have, I mean, it won't do Quake... like giant Quake levels. It will do certain things really well and certain things won't, not at all. So what I'm trying to say is that the engine isn't that complex.
Right.
And then, but the C C++ engine is highly optimized. Like all the data gets crunched and all the data gets prepared to be doing that one thing really well, really quick. And like loading is all optimized. Like everything is optimized in the C++ engine, but you could never... Well, if you tried really hard, you could make an editor in it, but it would really be really shitty.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of the reason I split it up. And then C++
like these
is
are
portable.
What these languages are best suited for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, C#, I love C# for making editors, because it's actually really quick to whip up UIs. And, like, the whole editor is basically one framework, and then just, and there's, like, a, sort of a tab system on the right, where, you, like, every tab is a different sort of component of the game. And each tab is just its own little sort of mini... editor subsystem, and I just derive from a class and go, okay, this is my new editor for this, or for levels, or for the turtle, or for enemies, or for groups, or whatever, and then it's quick to do that way. Yeah.
It's just weird because I was playing the real Texas, and I was like, oh, this is probably a Unity game. And I was talking to Kelvin, and he wrote his own C++ engine from scratch.
Wow.
Everything, like, and there's scripting in it, and I think it's Lua, and all this procedural stuff that I didn't know to make everything so like it doesn't look like anything's repeating, because he's cool. Like allergic to that. So it's just like he has to slightly offset textures, and so it was really awesome, but it was weird because like I have this Unity brain now, so I just look at games and like so I was looking at Chalkers, I was like, oh yeah, so they probably use this component to be, and I was like, wait a minute, no, they have their own stuff. So I guess that just felt weird to me, and it's actually a compliment, but just the fact that I when you play the game, you have no idea what went into making the tools, which is a good thing. But on the other hand, it kind of made me a little sad, just because the tools are so cool, but like people playing the game will have no idea that, you know, they're that cool. But that's just
maybe
how it
I should
goes.
Make a video or something.
It would be cool. Yeah,
I was like,
it would be cool to see
your dev blog post today about how you increase loading times.
Oh right. Well,
it got retweeted like crazy, though.
Yeah, but the thing is, I can't stand loading times, and like, seriously,
he's so mad.
No, I get mad.
Well,
certain games
playing,
take forever.
I was playing Jack Lumber, which is a game that one of my friends in Manitoba worked on, made in Unity, and it's actually doing. It's an iOS game. Got picked up by Sega Alliance, the first Sega Alliance title.
Cool.
Yeah,
and
yeah, it's
got really cool art style and stuff.
Yeah.
But it has like. Fairly substantial loading times in between screens, and I noticed with Shellraiser, like there's just nothing.
Yeah, it actually takes longer to transition out the screen than it is
load.
And transition in the new screen. Like that takes 0.2 seconds to transition out, and then transition in is 0.2 seconds again, and in between it loads, and it's literally like 0.1 seconds to load 30 megs of data or something like
that.
And it's a bit, I've heard it a lot that Unity some like I don't know what they're doing exactly, but I've heard it is slow and there's not much you can do about it, which is unfortunate, because
Uni Force coming out, they may have optimized that.
I hope
sure
they do,
because
but like if you have your own engine, there's no reason to have any loading screens. And if you do, you should read our blog post. I don't know. It's like, seriously, I did the test, and I had my, that was my iPhone 3G, actually, that I had at that time. And I was just like, well, okay. So I read the post by Carmack about the mmap
right.
function. And it basically just maps a file into an address and then just loads on the fly whenever you want to access it. And I was like, okay, cool. I want to try that. So I tried it out, and I was like, this can't possibly be right. I was like downloading, like I basically loaded like a 600 megabyte file onto my phone, and I just randomly read from it in like 1 megabyte chunks. And I was like, this can't, like, you know, I got the results. I'm like, okay, 300 megs a second, 300 megabytes a second. That can't be right. And I did it again. I tried some different things. It's like, yeah, no, that's it.
So what exactly is the difference in the method that makes that speed difference? Because you said he was mapping it to memory address, but what about that actually makes it?
Well, I don't quite know. Like, maybe Fread is that quick too, actually. I don't know. But, like, the cool thing about memory mapping is that you have just, we have one giant data file. And basically what it does is it you know how virtual addresses work, right? So, well, I mean,
not sure if I do.
Okay, well, normally
if you
allocate a piece of memory, you get a pointer.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then from that pointer onwards, it
right.
has memory allocated. Now, all these devices have like virtual memory addresses.
Right.
So they can allocate up, like a 32-bit one could go up to 4 gigs of potential memory that you could allocate. So it just says, okay, this address now is this file. Okay. But it doesn't actually load it in, nor does it actually allocate any memory. But what it does is it gives you a pointer back, and from that point you can just go, I want to read, I'm going to go 100,000 bytes forward, and I'm going to read whatever is in here. And then because the memory map function is such a low-level function of the kernel, you don't, because fread is like you're high up, and then it has to go through all these layers down into the kernel to
right.
actually read what,
so
like one
no
byte, and then it goes all the way back,
right.
and then you do that multiple times. So there's a lot of overhead,
right.
and memory map just goes, okay, lowest level, boom, that's where it is.
And so
I say, I want to know what byte that is, and it'll load in the stuff like while you're reading it, and it's because, well, all these devices are basically SSD drives.
Right.
In some shape or form,
right.
like maybe not complete SSD, but it's really quick. So they just like just do it. It's like it's amazing. I was working on a motorcycle racing game that I've actually never shown anybody except you guys, I guess. But and I was like, oh, let's see if this works. And I this is a giant world that gets generated. There's a lot of like large 2048 by 2048 textures. That are compressed with PVRTC, so the they're about like 4 or 5 megs each, and you're driving along the track, and each section of track, which is about 30 meters long or something, every time you cross the section, it will load in new textures and swap out the old textures, and it does that at like 60 frames a second, no problem. And I was just like, okay, this is pretty damn cool. I want to make something now that is actually using this, and well, the motorcycle racing game was gonna be it, but then. Yeah, when Shell Razor came about, I was like, all right, I can actually save memory by just, between screens, just flashing all the memory out.
Right.
Swapping to the new screen and loading only what that screen needs.
Doesn't even matter.
Arguing with 60 frames the entire time for dev.
Yeah, and it's,
That's
crazy. And again, to Nick's credit, because
on an iPad 2, maybe not an iPad 1 for a while.
I played on an iPad 1 all the time.
It was playable, for sure.
It's super playable. But
getting stuff playable on iPad 1 and 2 is not... easy.
Yeah,
I demoed Shellraiser at Seattle Indie Expo on an iPad 1 all day, and by the end of it, the battery was just shot to hell, and it was slowing down because it's like...
I'm actually glad it lasted the whole day.
Yeah,
like Nick's engine was rock solid. I think there were only 2 or 3 times in the whole development where I crashed the game.
Yeah.
Like, it was super, super rock solid.
That's probably something you tuned wrong.
User
error. That was the one thing we would always hear. User error! That's what's going wrong!
It's actually interesting when you look at all the hardware that... Well, I'm obviously only talking about iOS hardware, but like if you look at the iPad 1, it's actually the lowest powered... It's the lowest common denominator. Because it has the same sort of graphics processor as the 3GS monster. It's a way bigger screen.
Yeah,
way more pixels.
Yeah.
And the thing that the new ones are pretty good at it, but the thing that absolutely kills the iPad 1 is alpha blending.
Yeah.
It absolutely kills it.
Aquaria had major alpha blending issues until Andrew Church, the guy working on it, came up with this crazy algorithm to automatically generate polygons.
That's what
we do.
That's
what we do.
Actually, we don't actually automatically generate them.
Right,
Jesse automatically generates them by hand.
And
I actually do.
Nick does more than me. He said, this is therapeutic. I'm like, this is stupid.
You should make a minigame out of it. Crowdsource.
That'd be brilliant.
No, I've been thinking about actually automating it, but then, you know, there's always other stuff that comes along. So one day
we only managed to automate it for certain types of sprites, but obviously some were too small or too detailed, it wouldn't work. But,
right.
But I was just blown away by that.
It speeds your game up with a ridiculous amount.
Essentially, the idea is that you have geometry that is always going to be
full big.
Solid, won't have alpha blending on. And then you generate almost a strip. You can either generate a strip, or in the case of what Andrew did, he would render the solid stuff first to the Z buffer. And
that's
then
what
you,
I do, yeah.
You check to see if there's a thing written there, then yeah.
Yeah, and then you only have to actually alpha blend these tiny strips,
yeah,
and most of them get rejected by the ZBuffer right away. So
yeah.
it's really
so
quick.
It makes a huge performance difference. But it's really only an issue on iPad 1.
Yes.
So.
Well, it does speed up iPad 2 as well,
yeah.
I think. I don't know. It might actually slow it down. Because it's actually slower on a PC. If you actually do the alpha blended, or the alpha polygon thing.
Right, right.
It was actually slower on my dev PC for some reason. But
well, your dev PC is old.
Yeah, it's not that old. It's only 5 years old. Anyway. It's good enough for iPhone development, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah,
I've heard that you were ordering new computers.
Yeah, they're coming in tomorrow now, I think.
So they say.
And what are they? Can we geek out about
this? I got to remember. It's a quad-core, 16 gigs of RAM. 256 gig SSD drive with the two. By the way, okay, SSD drives.
Yeah.
Any self-respecting developer needs to invest in SSD drives because they are the shit. It is awesome.
So I use MacBook Air 11 inch. It's not the current gen, but it's previous gen.
Yeah.
That was my first SSD computer, and I love it.
It's so good.
Laptops, it's just instant on, and then
if you have
an
old laptop that is almost like you want to almost buy a new one,
just
stick it in the hard drive, stick an SSD in there, you're good for 3 years.
It's
amazing
though. It's amazing. This thing only has 4 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
But you never would notice because it can page swap so fast.
Yeah.
But it doesn't even matter.
Exactly. SSDs are awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway, where were we?
Yeah.
Specs. SSD drive.
2 terabyte hard drive. What was it, GeForce? It wasn't actually that crazy of a GeForce. 560 or something,
yeah,
or 570.
That wasn't the big thing.
I don't even know.
You didn't really need that much graphics power, right?
Yeah, but the main idea was that these computers that we have now, there's actually fans in the top that make so much noise that we have to hit them all the time. Because they start vibrating.
Oh, yeah.
And we hit them so hard that the whole fan came out inside the computer. So, and actually it happened to his case, to Jesse's case, and my case as well, so we're going to be super glad to get rid of those. So these next ones are going to be smaller, luckily. But yeah, they'll be pretty kick-ass, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Nice. I mean, for the stuff we do, for iPhone, you don't need that much.
Yeah. This, again, is using Nick's engine to make Shellraiser, is like us buying insane computers to work on iOS development.
Yeah. Well, and I got a new MacBook Pro, I guess, the Retina one, that one I quite happy with, so... That one actually runs Xcode okay.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Good old Xcode, everyone loves it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it works though, it's
I've never had issues with it, but the only time I see it is when Unity exports
Xcode
project and I just have to hit a button. And
that's actually how it works mostly for us too, because we have that system where
we
can actually develop the whole game on the PC, which is our sort of our preferred development platform. And you can actually test it on PC, and then once you're all done and it all works, then I sync up on the Mac and compile the Xcode, and it works. Usually right away. Yeah.
What do you guys use for source control?
SVN.
Oh, wow.
Why?
And you're okay with that? Do you guys all use...
I don't touch it. I use Dropbox.
Dropbox. That's why it works, because you're not worried about merging so much necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, it's kind of manually merging, but the stuff that Shane hits, the files that he changes, are not the ones I would change or he would change.
Right.
But is merging so much better in other Against source code merge, actually, isn't that bad, I found.
But Curiel, I guess, like, I think handles branching better.
Oh, okay.
As far as I understand it.
Yeah.
I've just heard horror stories about SVN, but
I don't know. Oh, they could vary, like, I don't know.
But, I mean, you're probably not going to run into it, because you're pretty much the programmer.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm also not really that knowledgeable on source control stuff.
Mm.
I like when I worked at Relic and Gorilla, it was all Perforce.
Yeah.
And then once I started my own thing, I was like, okay, I need something, and Jamie used SVN, so that's what I used. And I'm okay with it now. The cool thing, I don't know if anything else has it as well. It's probably very trivial, but what I like is that you can actually, you know, get your computer synced up and then go on the ferry where you have no Wi-Fi, and you can change all the stuff you want, and you can revert it right on that computer. It, you don't need an internet connection.
It's even a local.
It is a local
repository.
Yeah. So that I think is great, because I've actually used that quite a bit, where it's like, okay, I'm changing files, and I can actually go, what's the difference? What did I do? If something screws up, you can actually go back.
There's some developers who are still not using source control. Like,
well, that is insane.
Sophie Holden just makes multiple zip files of her Unity projects.
Wow!
And names them, and they keep saying, "Yeah." And
but even if you use Dropbox, telling,
you're like, "Yeah, I know."
Yeah, Dropbox remembers.
At least put it on Dropbox.
Yeah, like I use Dropbox and Time Machine. Like
Time Machine, Time Machine would work too.
Yeah.
It's basically sourcing.
Yeah, it's basically source control. Like, you can't see diffs and things like that.
Yeah.
You kind of got to remember what you're doing, but on one-man projects,
I'm actually surprised that not, like, outside game development, like, you know, my girlfriend is an interior designer, and they, you know, multiple designers working together with AutoCAD files and stuff. They use
no versioning,
no backups, nothing, and it's just like, oh, this is
so,
like, drawing
time.
One,
yeah.
This is drawing two, this is like,
right.
Oh my god, what happens if your computer crashes, or your server crashes? Oh, well, then we have to start over. I'm like, really? Wow.
Yeah.
It's just shocking.
I love watching. I teach and mentor at Vancouver Film School in the game design program, and I love seeing students on their final projects clumsy their way through whatever they're using for source control. Because all their naming conventions and their way of doing it, it's always haphazard, a total disaster. Always. It's like, what happened? Oh, we spent the whole day tracking down some Unity asset server bug. And
actually, the asset server has a bunch of ridiculous bugs, and they have ridiculous fixes. One is nuke your entire project and check it out again.
Oh, God.
Which I've done several times. And there's another one where it's just rename the folders that are being weird and then name them back, and then it'll be fine.
That sounds like a Unity fix.
Yeah.
So
like, when it works, it's
driver.
Great. You know, like, when it works, it's, like, I like the asset server in it.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to think about it, but...
Yeah.
When it screws up, it's so tedious.
But all the mistakes are all student mistakes, just because they've never done it before.
Oh, okay.
That's, yeah. But that's part of being a student, right?
Yeah.
That's why you have mentors and teachers.
Yeah.
I think that once you're used to source control, you just can't live without it.
Oh, yeah. You need to drive, don't you?
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, you still have
I don't need to drive.
Still need more wine.
Chug. Can't mix wines, come on.
I totally can.
Yeah,
I'm
your school of wine drinking, Alex.
Winnipeg style would be like turpentine in the back of like a stolen car.
Oh, nice.
Making a toilet like a prison, right, Sanger?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I remember working on games before source control. And I remember, I was just making stuff on my own and going around high school finding people who looked nerdy and asking them if they wanted to start a game company and shit like that. And then after my first year of university, I found this startup in the city that is actually still going, and they're expanding, and they've got some funding, and they're hiring QA people now, which is pretty cool. But they're like the only real game company in Winnipeg.
Right.
Like, there's like me and Noel. That's like pretty much it.
If you guys move away, what's going to happen to Winnipeg?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's like 50%.
I always tell people that Winnipeg is the coolest lame town in Canada.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much accurate, yeah. But yeah, I was kind of interesting because it was like learning by doing, but, you know, I didn't really have that much experience, like formal experience. I was just like learning Cube Basic on my own and stuff. And C on my own, C++ on my own.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd never used a debugger before. I remember the first time when the lead programmer on that project was like, are you using a debugger? And I was like, I don't know what that is. He's like, oh. He probably like facepalmed or something. He's like, okay, I'll show you what this is. And he was like, that's how I learned how to use the debugger. Because it was like, yeah, never
I don't know, though.
It's magical. It's like, is that not...
Yeah.
Like, if you're trying to program without...
You're like, oh my god,
yeah.
That solves such a huge problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But the weird thing is I don't use a debugger now, because I'm
really?
Using Unity.
Oh, yeah,
I
okay.
just debug log stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've only had to, like, step through...
Because you can see what's
times.
Happening, and you can mess with it, and
yeah.
move it around and tweak it, and you kind of really don't need the debugger as much.
Yeah, a debugger is definitely a handy tool, but if you know how to use it without a debugger, it's
yeah.
you're probably even more powerful.
You're saving time
faster,
for
yeah.
sure.
There's certain
yeah.
things where you just can't use a debugger, and then
right.
you just go back to your printf debugging, and
yeah.
it's fine, you know?
that's one thing I always find out with, especially full indie and talking to other developers, a lot of people that are like working on their first or second game are just learning those basic things that, you know, with Nick and I both working, well, all three of us working in games beforehand, we already learned those lessons coming in, you know, of like the right way to structure things. And,
right, yeah.
You know, the initial design for how we were doing level builds and groups and everything, when I first did it, was exactly how it ended up. You know, there was very few tweaks along the way because we'd all done it before, and that experience and having other people tell you the right way to do things is
right. So that's probably why you guys work so well together, is because you already knew what you were doing.
Yeah, and
to,
I think,
to a good
yeah.
degree.
And you know, Alexander Bruce said it. You know, he's really happy that he worked corporate for a little bit. You know, and same with Brian Pagiano.
Oh, I learned so much working in like AAA stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, you just learn.
Oh, there's also the work ethic thing, which I think is interesting. Like, when you work for a company and you have that crappy experience of, not constantly, hopefully, but, like, the boss, you know, saying you have to do this, but
mm-hmm.
when you go in on, out on your own after that, you kind of appreciate it more.
Yeah.
You kind of understand that this is serious business. You know, I can't just mess
around. I actually remember, well, I actually didn't have that many negative experiences at Relic, actually, but...
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely experiences where you're like, really? Why would you do that? And then
right.
after I went in, I was like, it kind of all makes sense.
Oh, I see
why
you do
that. Why, you know, why does the financial guy want all expenses before, you know, the 31st of the month? Like, why? And then you're like, next year, and it gets really shitty to backtrack everything. And, you know, stuff like that is interesting.
Yeah.
You know? Oh.
I think the biggest thing I miss from the big companies, which I was actually a little bit worried about moving into an office with only one other person, is I really like people. I really like talking
mm-hmm.
to people. And when you work in a big studio and everybody's a gamer, and during lunch everyone jumps on TF2 and you can hear the energy, like, oh man, like,
yeah.
that's
mm-hmm.
pretty awesome. Like, it's pretty wicked.
That sounds exactly like your DayZ experience.
Not
at all.
No, that was... Oh, it was bad. I was also trying to play DayZ on the current work computer, which isn't the hottest gaming rig on the planet.
It will be. The new one will be.
Maybe I'll play DayZ then. No, I can't get over their UI. I'm just sorry.
Yeah, I miss foosball.
Oh, I love foosball.
That's what I miss about work.
This is why people have co-working
yeah.
spaces.
Yeah.
You know?
Hacky sack.
The old building at Relic had like a patio on the top, on the roof. That was before you joined, I guess.
But I still play a lot of hacky sacks. So we can play it in the lobby.
Oh, like, but that's when all the lawyer types started complaining.
Oh, really?
You're
having too much fun.
Get back in there. Well, when I, like, moved to the Bentall 5 building, it was like a building full of, like,
bankers,
really high-end bankers and lawyers firms, and then all these game developers start
immaculately dressed.
In, like, shorts and, like, shitty shirts or whatever, like, you know, GDC shirts.
Playing hacky sack and having
safety in the lobby, and they're like, what is all this? Well, they all started complaining. It's kind of good, actually.
How did Relic get started? Didn't it start as a very small team?
Well, I think it all got started with Homeworld, right? Like, Alex Garden
pitched
Homeworld, and then Luke joined in, and a bunch of other guys.
Yeah, Rob and some of the others.
Rob Cunningham, yeah.
From the other group.
Do you think, like, if they were starting today, they'd be considered indie and they'd kind of go an indie route versus becoming more of a...
I think you needed the money from service work, like the publisher that gives you that month to month.
Well, I
really
think...
Deep. But Alex could have
started... No, but like, when Alex started, it was totally indie. And I, if they did the same thing now, I would still call them indie.
Yeah.
Because they're doing their own thing. And actually, Rob Cunningham started his new company, Blackbird Interactive, and they're basically doing... like their own game. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they have funding and stuff, I think. But
well, they've got venture capital funding, though, so they're still independent. They're not working with a publisher.
Yeah, they're totally doing their own thing.
Well, that game company
is
considered indie, but they're, you know...
Working with Sony.
Yeah, working really closely with Sony, so that's kind of another interesting edge case.
Yeah,
right?
I hope this doesn't go into what defines indie.
Yeah, well, it's going to be...
Let's stop right here.
It is going to be another pitch where they throw around. It's like,
game changer. It's
already kind of a useless word. Like, yeah. It has all these different connotations, but now it's getting to the point where, like, I keep seeing tweets where it's like, oh, the studio shut down. Oh, just go indie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, no, don't. It just seems like there's going to be this flood of an indie game, the movie, which I love, but again, it's going to inspire a bunch of people to go indie.
Yeah. I don't know. It looked like those guys had a hell of a time in that movie. I was like, this has to be their first gig because they're having a real problem. Like these poor guys. I guess you have to find the personalities, or else your movie's going to be really boring. Because I was thinking, like, man, what if they shot Shellraiser?
Be a pretty boring movie.
We had a good time.
We all love each other.
This is my daughter.
Yeah. She's cool.
We actually didn't work a weekend, and we didn't do overtime.
It wouldn't have made for a good movie.
And that's what I'm finding a lot of times.
But I do have to say, though, like, that movie did resonate with me as well, because
for sure.
Before we did Shellraiser, there was a lot of times where it was like, okay, you were talking about this before, actually, the whole self-doubt thing.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you start making a prototype, and you just seriously doubt if this is going to go anywhere. And in the beginning, you're super excited, and then your enthusiasm goes down. And you kind of need, like, that was actually good about the Shellraiser project, I think. You need the other person to be, no, this is still really awesome.
Yeah.
And then you're like, yeah, this is really awesome. And the next day, the other person's like, oh, this is going to be really shitty. And no, you just told me this is going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So you kind of need that thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I find that so it was the whole indie game, the movie was very recognizable, even though definitely some of those guys went like really deep to finish their game. I kind of hope if anybody's in a situation like that, like, talk to your fellow indie people.
I was talking to Tommy through some of it, and I know he was talking to other developers.
I'm not saying they didn't. I'm just saying it's like, you know what, they're like, I've just noticed that, you know, with the full indie thing starting up in Vancouver, you can get so much information and so much strength from other indies doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, if that helps you, do it.
And it's the hardest habit to break coming from traditional development where NDAs are you talk about your game, you're fired.
Yeah.
You know, it happens.
Yeah,
I had to sign
an NDA the other day. I was like, holy shit, I haven't done this in years.
You don't have to. Have you ever tried saying no?
No.
Oh, Ron Carmel did that to me once, because I was like showing him some stuff and I was like, oh, I'm signing an NDA, because I was just like, didn't know better at that point. And he was just like, no. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize he could say no. I don't know how Notch does that. Like, he tweets about how he, you know, refuses to.
It's really kind of dumb.
Doesn't actually do anything legally.
Yeah.
Like, in most cases, it's not going to be relevant.
And in this case, it wasn't another. I probably wouldn't. I don't know if I would sign an NDA with another indie developer.
Right.
But like, this wasn't.
You just laugh him out of
right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you see people that come from the traditional games into indie and are working on their own for the first time, and they're like, I can't tell you my idea.
Yeah, that's
like,
cool.
That's cool. Like, have fun, man. We just laugh. All the best.
This is hilarious.
All the best.
Our turtle is barely walking, it sounds like. Really, mm-hmm. But
well,
like, we were literally showing everyone. We knew about it.
Well, at the full indie, when you just had the concept art, I remember seeing you with a beer in one hand, and you were like, and then the turtle's gonna shoot a gun, and he's gonna blow up! And it was just a still image on his phone, and he was showing people.
Yeah.
And that was, and that was it. You know, when I went down to GDC in March, I had, we had three weapons in the game and one level, and every single person I knew, I was like, hey, put the game in front of them, right? And because if they could work faster than us and get the game done faster than us, more power to them.
Yeah,
if they could convince their boss to sign off on a game with a turtle with guns,
they don't have to completely switch
power.
Direction on whatever they're working on.
Exactly.
And like, invest all the time and resources into catching up to where you're at.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's gonna do that.
And and the biggest hurdle is that they would actually have to ditch their own idea that they're excited about, which is like the biggest thing. That's why I don't have any problems telling another person, like, hey, I was thinking about making a game about this. Because they have their own ideas anyway.
The thing is, like, even
they're not going to change their
ideas are so useless. Like, execution is so important. Like, if you took Jesse's concept art that was the core of the game and gave it to 10 different companies and told them they all had to ship that game, you'd have 10 different games.
Yeah.
No matter what, you know? And it's... ideas are just useless. Execution is so important. And
I think everybody's been in a position where they've worked on something they really care about, and they can't even talk about it until it's released or until it's like,
That has to rot you. Like, that has to just tear you down. Like,
I
worked at District 9. I worked at District 9. Like, or something like that.
Yeah, right.
You're just trying to tell people. But with indie, it's like, hey, you've been here for this whole journey.
Yeah.
All my tears, all my love, my good times and bad times. You guys, we dragged you along. And that's way better way.
Yeah, you go to a conference. Like, what are you working on? Unannounced project. Oh, I've heard about that. That's pretty good.
That was my biggest wake-up call ever. When I first went to the IGS, like the Independent Game Summit at GDC, I was just like, and then I just quit and Relic and, you know, went on my own and stuff like that. And it's just like, everybody there was just talking about stuff. There was no, like, oh, I can't talk about this. It was all so open and so...
Well, the best thing is, like, oh, we're going to school. And then, like, the first few years I went to GC, it was just, like, the first time I went was when Aquaria was nominated. And it was just, like, talking to all these people I'd never met or even heard before. And it was just amazing to talk to them. And then I think the next year, people had laptops, and they were showing us some laptops. This year, it was, like, everyone had iPad holsters. And
yeah,
nice. Yeah,
I love
that. Yeah.
Just, like, here, play this, right? And it's so convenient now.
It's
and
so
it's
portable.
Fast,
like,
and it's just...
You are a booth walking around.
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
A card and an iPad, and everyone can experience.
So I'm trying to get my friend from Winnipeg who are working on this Roboteer game to try and get him down to pass.
Hells yeah.
We don't have a booth, but he now has an iPad,
yeah.
So he can just hopefully get some people.
Arrest media badge people.
Yeah, gorilla stuff.
That's what we're probably going to have to do. Because we didn't get a booth either, because we didn't know how Shellriz is going to do.
And PAX 10 didn't like us either.
What's that?
PAX 10 didn't like us either.
Oh, I did. Probably liked us, but they didn't choose us for the PAX 10. Yeah.
Not as good as Offspring Flame, so...
Yeah.
Are they in PAX 10?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So that's why I got a pass.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, sweet. Well, good.
So...
Nice.
I get to pretend like I'm important again, which is nice.
Yeah, that was funny.
So you have to demo the entire day?
I mean, Kyle, it's Kyle's baby, so he's going to be the one demoing it, but I want to be there.
I hope he has, like, multiple pairs of shoes.
But he's also there for Snapshot. Snapshot's going to be in, I think, the Indie Mega booth, but also Sony has a booth, and they have the PS Vita version of Snapshot.
Right.
Oh, cool.
So, but I think he's going to dedicate himself to the Offspring Flame.
Awesome.
Booth, but
it'll be fun to see all the indies in PAX for sure.
So
I'm
many
actually
people
looking forward
down.
To
it. Yeah. Yeah. When we talked about PAX and getting a booth, it was really funny, because it's like, we didn't know we were going to get featured. You know, like, even when Apple contacted us and said, hey, can you send us the screenshots? This is not a guarantee you're going to be featured, but can you send us these art assets in case we decide to feature you? And, you know, the day before the game, the game release, I had friends over playing Magic the Gathering, and they're like, how do you feel? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, tomorrow, I
can
open up the App Store, and I could be like, hey, cool, we got featured, and it doesn't matter. Or, hey, we didn't get featured, and it doesn't matter. Or it could be like, hey, we got featured, and the game's doing really well, crazy. And...
Yeah.
That question mark, because in traditional games, you know, if your game's going to do well, you know. The press is all over it, you know, the ads are out there, you know, the review scores are coming in.
And even if it does poorly, it's not, it's still going to do well enough.
Well enough, yeah.
It's
your incel to the retail channels are going to be good enough, right?
I think the whole iOS, or mobile anyway, the mobile press cycle is completely inversed. From what it is in retail.
Yeah.
Everything needs to be out before the launch. And it seems like on iOS, everything has to be out
after the launch.
People can go buy it immediately.
Yeah.
It's really odd.
The impulse buy. So it was such a weird thing shipping this game that we knew it was good. We knew it was a fun game. And everyone we put it in front of really loved the game. And they weren't just saying it because they were our friends.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have no idea. You have no idea if you're going to make... You know, $100,000 or $1,000. And that was the spectrum that you have to, know. Like, I spent 6 months of my life working on that spectrum is really weird, you know, coming from, you know, traditional games where you have a good idea.
Also, you're seeing what's being released during your release. You're like, holy, these guys?
Yeah, we're up against Walking Dead.
Walking Dead?
Last time I checked.
The App Store is terrifying now.
It's scary.
I can't conceive of how I would even go about releasing something for it without... somebody who knew more than I did about it. Because to me, it's just, like, terrifying. It's like, what if we choose this release window and then, some amazing thing.
Yep.
And people are going to forget about it.
Comes out that day.
Yeah.
You're like, yep, I don't know.
It just seems like it's so fast and things are sort of smaller in a way compared to, like, a longer form game or whatever. And it's just like, you're going to be forgotten in a week if nobody... If it doesn't catch on, it's just horrifying.
And it's like top 25 desert, desert, literally lifeless, nothing. And there's, I remember when I was in sixth.
And that sucks, you know, because
it's the worst.
Yeah, the thing about the internet that I always found really hopeful was, like, okay, there's a niche for everyone.
Yeah.
So if I make something really good that's very particular, it'll find its niche and it'll be
like Steam's good for that, right? Steam helps games.
Even
fine.
Just releasing on your own site used to be good.
Yeah.
At least I don't know if it still is.
It still can.
I think Calvin's doing good on that.
Yeah, but the price point's so key too, though. Like,
right.
At 99 cents is such a difference than a $10 game. You know,
yeah.
Like, it doesn't. You know,
there's a whole side effect of people invest less time in
it's
stuff
disposable.
Too. Like, and that's how I feel about my iPad games, and I'll play them. I love the iPad as a gaming device. I want
yeah,
to
too.
Play stuff on it. But I don't, really. Like, I'll play stuff for, like, a few minutes, and then I'll switch to another game and play for a few minutes. It's this whole ADHD sort of thing, and I miss the longer-form experience, but I don't have the patience for it anymore.
But
so
is it your behavior changing, or is it just that the games aren't that long-form on there? Because a lot of games
both.
Are... Which, yeah.
I think it's, like, the devices I'm using have changed my behavior.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
You know, I've adapted to them,
mm-hmm.
and then the games are adapted to those devices, and they're all about these small... Like, even the icons are small, and there's,
mm-hmm.
like, this one little idea. It's not,
yeah,
it's not
yeah,
like
yeah.
you're going to play a game and get 10 cool ideas mixed in, like... You know, old giant RPGs would sort of have, like, oh, it has this theme, but there's
yeah.
these sort of sub-themes, and we're
right.
going to weave them together. It's just like, it's a game where you cut logs, and that's the game.
Yeah.
And it's really well made, it's polished, but that's... I'll play it for 5 minutes while I'm taking a shit, and, like, you know.
What we're going to see in games, though, is the same thing that happened in television, is television sucked balls. And Hollywood, you know, completely...
Hmm?
Sorry, I need to get my laundry.
You try to do it all subtly.
It is an old Mercedes now from the success. Nick still has to do his own
laundry. If you look at, like, television was sucking balls through most of the 90s. It was terrible. Just horrendous television. And Hollywood kind of stepped up their game. And then, you know, HBO came out with a few good series. And then, you know, television really stepped up their game. You know, and if you look at where television was in the mid to not late 90s and where it is now, the writing is just so much better. The cinematography is better. And what I think is going to happen is in games is we've got all these flat experiences, and they're instantly gratifying, but they lack depth. And even when there is depth, it's not true depth. Like, if you look at, like, what would the Game of Thrones of video games be on mobile?
Right.
You know, nobody has the patience. Like, if you don't watch the first episode of Game of Thrones, you don't get in. Where do you go with that in games? And I think what I found for me myself personally is over the winter, I just got crazy into hardcore, insane, difficult, really deep games. And that's all I wanted to play. Like, I was looking at frame data for Street Fighter and watching fighting game streams and loading up, you know, 100 plus hour RPGs, which I hadn't played since I was in college, and just being like, yeah, I am in. I am in for this. Because, you know, for 6 years as a gamer, all I was playing were mobile games and casual games, because that was what I was working on a lot of times. And then, or I was working and having a child, where you don't have any time for games.
Yeah,
so all you have are these, you know, you might play, you know, I have still haven't finished Mass Effect 1, you know, because when Mass Effect 1 came out, I had a baby and I was producer on Company of Heroes, you know, so you just don't have the time to finish an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, that's what I crave. I, you know, I want a deep game. I want to sink in. I want to master, you know, all the crazy hard levels in Mario. I want to dig in and really develop that higher level. And I think we're going to see that in the same way we see it in television and other media. We're going to get an evolution. So we're going to get past these, you know, the Skinner boxes or the flat games and get into games that have more emotional resonance, more depth in gameplay, and are more challenging. Because right now there's no challenge. You know, like, you can see it. Yeah, you know, I really want to see the
thing. The key is designing a game that anyone can pick up and play for at least, I don't know how long, you know.
Yeah, like, where does the curve come in?
Yeah.
Like, and now it's also so Me Too. It's just, like, all the mobile scene, especially, is all this Me Too stuff. Like, oh, well,
right.
we put Angry in front of our game title, and we have a physics game, so.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's trying to, they're too busy chasing processes instead of just making something they love and want
to
make.
I was actually, to be honest, I was a little bit surprised because a lot of people were saying, oh, Shellers, it's so unique.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
I was like, no.
But, you know,
but
it's,
no
yeah,
yeah,
not
yeah.
much. You know, like, it's just different than Angry Birds, really.
Yeah,
it's,
like, it's funny.
It's a multi-touch shooter. That's like the only really unique thing in there. Like,
yeah, but it's not even, I don't know, I don't see that as, like, a revolutionary
no, it's not.
Idea.
It's
like,
so really
we
need to take the wheel and reinvent it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we just made something that kind of made sense, and I don't know. It, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't a directly derivative of something else. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, it was. It stands on its own. It's not. You can't say,
yeah.
"Hey, this is just like blank."
Yeah.
But it's still. It's not. Wow, that's a completely new gaming experience I've never had before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. You know. A Dear Esther. You know,
mm-hmm.
where you're like, wow, I've never had that in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, whoa, that really changes your perspective on it. Chellblazer is not that game.
No, that's why I was very, very surprised that some people were saying that the game was so unique. And it's purely because of the market, I guess.
Yeah, they're so
iOS.
Used to derivative games.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It was
so
cool.
Sorry if you guys could comment a bit on the whole basketball thing, because I don't know if you know the story.
Oh, we know the story.
We know the story, yeah. You might know more than I do.
Shane knows a lot about it.
Well, I just read the article. Right?
Well, yeah, I've read the article too, but you have a pretty strong opinion.
I tried the game after I read the article.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I did play it after that. I was like, oh, okay. Well, first of all, I didn't even know about basketball before it came out.
Oh, really?
I read the article.
Okay.
Well, I heard about it, but...
Yeah,
I
heard about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, from your Twitter and from Kurt
mm-hmm.
and a few other people. And, you know, I follow Mike and Greg on Twitter and...
Yeah.
You know, so I knew it was coming, and I was looking forward to it, but I was surprised. I think for me, I'll take Jesse's cue when you say I have a strong opinion of it. I was surprised they went free, because
I was shocked. To
yeah.
be honest, I was like, because I played a bit of it at GDC, and like Mike had it on his iPad holster, and
mm-hmm.
I was like, I couldn't get the hang of the controls, but I was impressed by the game and kind of actually like, fuck, like my friends are just making way more awesome shit than I am. They're gonna do amazing. And I was actually kind of jealous
mm-hmm.
and upset, like not seriously, but just kind of like, oh, that's really cool, you know. And it's like, and then like, yeah, the release. I helped out with the trailer that Kurt shot. And I was
the
live
action one.
Yeah,
yeah, and I was all excited
cool.
about, you know, seeing the trailer come out, like how many hits
yeah.
is it gonna get, and the way that they released the trailer was a little odd, and like it didn't get covered anywhere.
Yeah, the coverage was really weird.
And then it was like, okay, it's free, and I actually downloaded it for free, and I was like, okay, cool. I played it a bit, and then I didn't even buy the in-app purchase.
Yeah, well, I couldn't
because,
find it.
But I didn't even think about it. Like I think I knew it was there, but I just but if it had been for whatever amount of money, I would have bought it instantly because I was waiting for it.
Yeah,
like.
Like when we did Shellraiser really early on, and we were talking about building in the role playing systems, that was so we could have a net purchase. Was a part of it, was saying
mm-hmm.
we can do this, and with this we can make purchasable coins. We
yeah.
can, you know, we can do these things. And then the idea of how we tuned it was, if you're a player with lots of skill, or a player with lots of time, or a player with lots of money, you can have fun playing this game. So
right.
if you are a skilled player,
but neither
player,
one is mutually like you don't have to have. Money ever,
yeah.
yeah.
If you have skill or time,
yeah. So it's like if you're a good player, you can play beginning to end without repeating any levels. You know,
so
you're good at the
you
game.
You guys really don't like people who are busy and unskilled and don't have any money.
Yeah, we don't have a game for them.
That's
sorry, people, we don't have a game for. I'm really sorry if you're that person. Our game isn't for you. But that went in like
yeah.
that was from when I was working on Company of Heroes Online at Relic, and we were dealing with Shanda when free to play wasn't even in North America at all. And this is one of their founding principles that they built on.
Hmm.
And so I just cribbed that from them. But I did a ton of homework. You know, I was working on, you know, free concepts for years. And
I
did the research. And
exactly.
that was what surprised me.
I think need a certain formula to be successful.
Yeah. yeah. You can't just make it free and wait for the money hose to start pouring into where you are.
Yeah.
Which
it totally depends on what you have. I don't know.
And it's a game, it's not a game, when you think about basketball and the systems in it, it's not a game where you can build any sort of time restriction, so you can't say, okay, well, you're going to upgrade this new hoop or a new backboard that's going to give you more deflection, but that's not going to upgrade for 3 days. You can spend money to upgrade it faster. That doesn't make sense in their game. Any sort of virtual currency doesn't really make sense in their game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good standalone game. You know, like,
yeah.
what it is,
yeah.
it's a game that, if it was on iPad for $3, we would have a totally different story right now. We'd be
that's
like,
right.
hey, Mike and Greg are doing awesome. Because
yeah.
they got featured, the screenshots look good,
it's,
the name is catchy,
looking game,
it's a fun-looking game.
Yeah,
the feedback
I would have
there.
Thought that people would have bought it just to try it.
Yeah.
Because it is, if it's under $5, it's in that range of just, well,
yeah, it's very viable game.
I guess
yeah.
I'll try it, you know. And
exactly. I think that they went free without a free plan, and you know that was the fatal mistake.
They're getting some interesting press now, though. Tons
they
of
get,
it, right?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing too, though, is that like relatively, if you look at Shellraiser, because we were a dollar
And how many downloads do we have now? Like 120,000
or something? I think we're at 130 now.
Yeah. Which, compared to what the download numbers that they got a ton more downloads, right?
So
but you have to have a plan
but
to...
But they're in this interesting position now where, or at least they were, where they had a ton of downloads and an opportunity to do something with that. And
right.
I really wanted to interview them at that point in time.
Right.
Sure.
They felt way too shitty about everything
yeah,
to
right.
want to sit down and talk about it, which
right.
I think is unfortunate, but...
But I think the key there is not to... Well, they'll get over their shitty
thing,
right?
Sure.
And then just go, okay, we still have that many downloads.
Yeah.
It still means a lot of people have your app on their phone.
Yeah.
Do something with that. You can still
push
change stuff. But that's
yeah.
the thing. That's the nice thing about Apple and
yeah.
or like the iOS system. You
mm-hmm.
can do an update.
Yeah.
Like, we're doing updates
yeah.
because... Well, actually, we just did an update. We didn't say updates. Yeah,
we did update one.
But, I mean, the cool thing is you have the opportunity to shape your game. And
mm-hmm.
and I think if they shape it more so it's more aimed towards, you know, the free-to-play market. Like, they mentioned in their articles that they looked at all the free-to-play games that are out there, and a lot of them are almost like money vacuums. Which... Right from the start, when we were doing Shellraiser, we said we don't want to be
yeah.
an absolute money vacuum.
No,
and I don't
no
think we are.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
No paywalls, no like... Just
we don't limit the play session length. If you want to play for 8 hours in a row,
yeah.
you can do it in Shellraiser. If you want to, you know, like, there's no limit to... Like,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of
right.
games that just stop. You have to stop playing now and come back later unless you want to give us money. We
yeah,
didn't want to do that.
The whole energy systems.
Yeah,
but,
the energy systems.
But between that... And being, you know, the Smurfs, which I find the most amazing money grab game on the freaking planet. It's brutal.
Like, what's specifically about it?
Well, first of all, the Smurfs,
like, so.
I find, the Smurfs is for kids.
Right.
Okay, right? So you build a hut for an extra Smurf, and I don't know the actual numbers, I might be off here, but like... You can build a hut, and it takes 24 hours. Julie was actually playing it, my girlfriend. She was pissed off about it so much. This is stupid. Anyway, you build a hut, and if you want to speed it up, because it takes 24 hours to build a damn thing, if you want to speed it up, it basically costs you somewhere in the range of like $5 or something like that. And the biggest in-app purchase you can get in that game is $100.
Yeah.
And to me, you can't do that in a kid's game.
That just seems... morally wrong in any game to me. Like, it's like $100. Like, unless you're offering,
exactly.
like, okay, here's an entire RPG with special bonus content and like
bookends.
A cloth map and some collectible
or
stuff.
Or if you spend $100,
like,
you never ever have to worry about any coins
ever
again.
Yeah, you're just
going to
own
right?
everything. God
exactly.
knows
yeah.
unlock
exactly.
it. You just like, rule the game.
And,
right?
and
but
you know, so
do
does that end?
Right.
And then there's the exact opposite end, and I
mm-hmm.
personally, I feel like the basketball thing went too far towards the opposite end of that, basically giving away too much
right.
for free. But I'm sure, I mean, they have a ton of installs, so you can totally do something with that.
Yeah, it's definitely salvageable.
I don't know.
The thing is, like, I'm curious what you would even do at this point, because, like,
that's,
if you were starting from scratch, you could do something. Well, let's cut this out because
right.
people will really want this. We can tease it, but. Not
yeah.
put it in, or whatever. But now you're kind of in a position where they have all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to take it away because that's going to look really
yeah.
weird.
I don't know what Jamie Chang is doing with Eats because he's working on Eats for
mm-hmm.
iPad. I would probably just call Jamie. If I was Mike and Greg, I'd be like, "Hey Jamie,
yeah.
what do you guys do?"
He could definitely give you some advice on that.
Yeah.
He would have some ideas.
And which, you know what, anytime I have a problem, I usually just call Jamie. Hey Jamie, what would
yeah.
I do here?
Like,
my wife's crying. What do I do?
Green shirt, red shirt.
I don't know. What should I wear? You always look so good. Your hair's amazing.
Really
hey
does.
Jamie, what should I name my firstborn? What do you got for me, Jamie?
What do you got?
Also, what Gaspar said interesting is it's a lot of indies have this problem of like they feel bad asking. To make money.
I don't understand
well,
that though.
No,
like,
but, like
I, honestly,
do.
Like
it's
no,
everywhere.
No, I understand it to a point. Like I remember, Aquaria came out for $30, which at that time was still a ton of money. Now it would be probably more ridiculous. But Derek was really confident about that, so I felt okay
mm-hmm.
doing it. But if I was on my own, I'd probably be like, I don't know,
$5, $2.
I'll pay you if you take it.
Yes.
but it's that kind of attitude, you know, which honestly is a pathetic attitude. I mean, I'm referring to myself, you know, but I don't know if that's how Mike and Greg go through it, but
sure.
That's why I really want to talk to them about it, because I'm curious if it's this kind of like, oh, we we know we did a good job, but really we don't want to bug people. And you kind of have to bug them a bit.
Well, that's the thing, though. I think there's a fine line between actually bugging and... You know what you want to do is you want to get into a point where people want to give you money.
Yeah.
You don't bug them. They want to give you money.
They're just like,
that's where
do I
be.
Put my money? And I just now, like, hurry up because I need to give you money.
The only time we ask players if they want to buy virtual coins in Shellraiser is when they're out of money and they're trying to buy something.
Yeah.
And then a pop-up comes in and says, hey, do you want to buy new coins? It says, heck yeah, or maybe later.
Yeah.
And the original
one
said, heck yeah, and no way. And I was like, guys, maybe we can make a little bit less suggestive.
Yeah.
Like, maybe later is better than no
and it's like, it's got some goofy art, but one guy's got a bill, and the one guy's out of, he's got the pockets unturned, and the moths are coming out. Like, it's all like, like, we're not like, listen up. Here's your paywall, buddy. Like, you need to buy more coins. It's totally passive. And I think a lot of people really resonated
with
that.
So how much, but how much do you actually make out of that system versus strips?
So it has changed with the number of installs and the number of in-app purchases related to installs, etc. I think in-app purchases are somewhat behind.
Yeah, it's like a wave. It's like if we see a bubble in the sales spike, you'll see a bubble in the in-app purchase, like, a few days later.
Yeah. And, but it's a lot higher than we expected.
Yeah.
A lot higher.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, actually, is that we have different coin packs, and the $10 one is the most... You get the most coins per dollar that you spend, obviously, because
it's
the biggest coin pack. And it's actually one of the most popular ones.
It's
and
second
like,
or third?
It switches between the 40,000 coins.
Yeah.
40,100. The number one seller is the bookie who doubles all the coins you collect.
Yeah.
And I did a talk on Monday night at the Design Dojo, which is like a local video game designers meetup that happens every couple of weeks. And I said, some people just buy the game for 99 cents, go in the store and spend another $2 and buy the bookie. And as I said that, three people put their hands up in the audience like, yep, that's me. I'm that guy right here. And, you know, that was how they wanted to play the game. And other people will buy the coins.
I think a lot of people don't buy anything.
Yeah, and tons of people don't. And that's the cool thing. Like, I think with free-to-play... you have to understand the vast majority of your players are never going to give you
any money. You guys aren't technically free to play
at
this point.
But the in-app purchase mentality is still like a free to play mentality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't, you know, again, I've got a game for people with lots of skill. They should never give us any money. I've got people with lots of time who just can grind and earn money.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have to give us money. The people whose money is worth more than their time, then they can give us money. And for me, the reason I sleep well at night is there's a game called Battle Heart, which when we first started working on this, I was just kind of...
That's
a
Unity game, right? Yeah.
Is it Unity?
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, cool.
I really like that game.
It's great.
It's by the Zombie USA.
Yeah.
I love those games.
It's a great game.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
and I was just coming out of a huge Battle Heart addiction, and I was two levels from the end, and I knew I needed to change my party, but I didn't want to grind to power level a guy. And I said, you know what? The Paddle Heart just said, dude, give us $10 and this guy will be level 20 from level 5 or
and
whatever.
You would have done it because you actually like the game.
Because I love the game.
And you're like, I'm fine with paying this guy $10.
Yeah, let's see Paddle Heart 2.
It's actually kind of interesting because if you look at Shellraiser, basically what you're doing, if you're buying in-app purchases, you're almost cheating. like you're buying progress rather than...
That's kind of what RPGs have always been about.
It's
always been about finding out, like, setting up a system and then setting up ways for the player to cheat the system.
And as a developer, I'd rather they give us that money than give GameShark the money. You know, it's not like...
Sure,
like, opening up the save file
GameShark
and hacking it has been around
GameShark
for a while.
GameShark for iPad now?
But you,
it'd be awesome.
People were hacking our game and posting how to hack the save file weeks after we were done. And every game has that. You know, any game that you're playing, if you search hard enough, you can find out how to hack your save file on an iPad. I would rather that we make it easy and convenient for them to do it. And if they want to do it, there's nothing blocking them. But our expectation is not that 90% of our customers will become in-app purchase customers. The expectation is, you know, launching, we were saying, if we can do 1%, we're psyched. And we did much better than 1%. But
and also, when we were actually launching the iPhone game, I guess one of the main things you're seeing now in iOS, the iOS market space, I think, in general, is that these huge conglomerates of games that are linking together. Like Gree or, what's it called?
Blue games
that are like, connected to each other, and we're like, well, you know, having a game out is good, and then having another game out that actually links them both together is even better.
Right.
So it was mostly like, okay, you know, if we do get a lot of installs, that's actually a really good thing, right? Because now we can also say, hey, there's a new game out, you know, look at this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our costs are fairly low because we're so few people. So if we can...
Also, Nick's one of the most underpaid programmers I know. Like,
well,
savagely underpaid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but honestly, if I have to wait, like, look at my life now versus when I was working at Relic, yes, there was more money when I was at Relic, but I'm having just as much, if not more, fun
right
now.
Yeah,
more fun. So, you know.
I'm a lot happier.
Yeah.
I went to India and lost 50 pounds in the first year and a half.
Hey, me too.
Yeah.
Maybe not 50, but...
I was also saying, it's a quality of life choice.
Is that just from not buying food?
No overtime food, less stress.
Oh, right.
The ability to say, you know what, I want to go for a walk. And so you go for a walk instead of sitting behind your desk all day, right?
Yeah.
You know, those little things all added up.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still good. I'm just...
Yeah. But, yeah, so it was a good lifestyle choice. But the overtime food, man.
Oh, it's savage. It's like pizza and
actually,
working till midnight is what the...
Just not going for lunch. I actually stopped going for lunch.
Oh yeah,
like out to the restaurants. At Relic at one point, and I basically right then and there just lost so many.
Eat an apple and some crackers instead of going out and getting a huge dish of Thai food.
Yeah,
that's probably better for you.
Yeah, or penne pasta.
Yeah,
so good. My favorite is penne pasta. Stopped eating that, and I lost a lot of weight.
It's interesting. I only had one sort of experience with that, the company I joined after I left university, but it was a totally new company at that point. We had no idea what we were doing. We were just in Winnipeg, and we're like, let's start a game studio. All right, you know, and we were working, like, insane hours, and I remember, you know, a whole day of, well, the only thing I consumed was, like, a bottle of Coke. It was, like, the only sustenance. I was just so excited to be working on this and really wanted it to work, and it was horrible. Like, the end result game was horrible, but it's weird, that mentality, because it is this sort of, like, sense of belonging to something that I really like that part of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see myself really getting sucked into that. But I never joined another company like that ever. Like, I never did the mainstream thing, really.
It sounds a lot like the first company I joined.
Hmm.
Like, it wasn't Lost Boys Games at the time, it was Digital Infinity, but that got merged with a bunch of other companies.
Oh, okay.
But it was basically like that. I was programming from my own... from my house for a while, and all I had was like Coke and chips. That's what I programmed on.
In the dream,
yeah. And then when that company started, it was basically like a big LAN party every day, and it was super fun. But like, yeah, I can't imagine that now because looking back at it, was, you know, now I'm way more productive and more happy.
And all you do is eat. What, chocolate sauce and then bananas and sugar sprinkled on top?
Yes. Me?
Yeah.
Right now? No, not anymore. I don't eat that.
What kind of
sweet strawberry sandwiches. Like,
yeah,
some
strawberry
kind of
sandwich.
Health.
Oh, that's so
like,
good.
With sugar sprinkled on top.
He's like a little
sandwich, a little bit of butter, sliced strawberries, and sugar. Just a tiny bit of sugar, not too much, just to break the...
Yeah, we're getting him committed.
Oh,
like,
that's so good.
Yeah. That's like the craziest
okay,
thing.
I have Dutch tendencies when it comes to lunch.
You're allowed. You're Dutch.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm still tall and skinny, so I'm okay. Yeah.
I'm kind of curious how much of that, though, like, because we're sort of all coming from a background of working for a company, although mine is more like a bunch of dudes pretending to be a company at the beginning, but, you know, when you're sort of doing that and you're aware of it and then you become free of it, it's different than if you just sort of started with the expectation of...
Right.
Indie is the way to go. And I'm curious about people who are going to start in this with this expectation of, oh, you can just be like Edmund and Tommy and just make a game, you know, and it'll work out.
But they didn't just make a game.
I know, but
thousands of games before they made it, right?
I'm aware of that, but I'm not sure how many of their fans are aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure how many of their fans are just like, they made Super Meat Boy and it was great, and so I will make that kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting. I wonder how much, you know, if it'll be different or not.
The same thing.
I mean, it's probably the same thing where you start and you're really naive and you make a bunch of dumb mistakes and then you just get
this
better.
Is probably the best thing about the Apple being a non-juried distribution network is it's open for anybody to come on and fail on.
Right.
And, you know, and that's what a lot of people do. I'm going to be an indie developer and I'm going to make an iPhone game and I'm going to make $1 million. We hear that hourly, right? Like, everyone talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
And if the game is good, it will get recognition, it'll find the press, it'll find its audience, and it might not make the person who made it wealthy, but it'll
be a success of some sort.
Like, I think, you know, the week we launched, there was a game called 1 Million that came out, and it got a huge amount of press, and it climbed up the charts because it wasn't featured, but based entirely on word of mouth and press, and I thought that was amazing, because that can still happen, right? I don't think it ever broke the top 25, but, you know, it did well.
Got somewhere.
Yeah, where, you know, I've seen so many projects come out where it's just like, hey, check out my new indie game, and the guy's going crazy on Twitter and adding everyone, and you go and you check it out, and you're just like, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
But if I look at my own experience, like, I would recommend every single new, like, person who wants to go indie, work at a bigger company first. I know it's hard right now, because it's, you know,
there's more bigger companies aren't hiring.
Yeah, in this city, it's especially horrible, but, I just think that if you actually do work on even just bigger projects, there's so many problems that the bigger projects have probably already solved.
Right.
That when you go smaller, like localization, every single string in your game has to be potentially localized. So when you start your own thing, you're immediately going to solve that problem. You're not even going to go, oh, well, I'll just put in strings for now. No, because you know it's going to bite you in the ass later. Right?
Interestingly enough...
Sorry.
I had no clue about that. I think I had at some point a stringbank.txt file for Aquaria. Because at some point I realized I should probably do this.
Yeah.
But there were still strings somewhere else in the code probably
that
I forgot about. What happened with Aquaria is there were at least two different people who were willing to convert the code, port it, modify it. At that point, where I didn't even have to remember what the hell I was doing. But that's, you know,
I mean,
a case
it's just
where
an
you
example,
have,
right? It's an example. This localization is one thing.
Yeah.
But, like, just in general, like, trying to do all your processing outside the game. Don't do any processing in the game. Like, push it all to the editor. Stuff like that. Or, you know,
but
console,
so, like, rules of
making
thumb,
a console game.
But
yeah,
you
rules
have no
of
idea
things.
When you're starting from nothing. Or
exactly.
Nothing,
but when you just go straight into a bigger company like that, it's normal.
Yeah.
And you accept it as being normal. And if you have to make all those mistakes first yourself,
yeah,
it's going to take you a long time.
And it's going to really if hit your first shippable product.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
You've been spending so much time.
I just think, really, like, joining a company, even though you might not want to do that, but, you know, I wanted to start my own company, but I worked at bigger companies at first, and it was actually really good learning experience.
Yeah,
and honestly, sometimes I think, hey, maybe I should go work at a bigger company again. Purely to learn from people.
Yeah, just
because like, you work with so many talented people that really know their shit, right? Or are very specialized in one thing, and, like, they're really good at it. And you can learn so much.
Yeah.
And that's actually kind of what I'm slightly missing being on my own sometimes, right? But, you know, obviously you talk to other indies, but they're also doing everything for their game. They're not just focusing on one thing.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the hard thing about... just getting that one job, though, is there's a lot of bad game companies out there now.
Right.
You know, like, when we broke in, if you weren't making 70% or higher games, you weren't making games, where there's a lot of games that are game companies that are startups or just make, you know, shovelware, and it's really easy to pick up bad habits.
And, you can also just get completely disenfranchised, I think. But you're just like, well, game industry's shit.
When I left EA, I thought I was done with games. You know, I left EA after 5 years to go and make BMX videos for a couple of years, and I thought I was done with games because I thought EA was the only way you made games. And then I got in at Nokia, where I was working with, you know, three or four companies, different companies a year, and I was like, oh my god, you can make games in so many different ways, and you saw all these different things. But if you come into one company and it's all, you know, the games are garbage, the management is garbage, and the budget sucks, and you've got horrible shares. So it's like, just getting a job isn't good.
I see a flaw in my advice right now. Because the game companies I work for are pretty awesome.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like,
you have to pick your companies and be lucky enough to get it.
There's a reason when I started at Relic that I was, like, dancing down the hall with a big shit-eating grin on my face, because I was the happiest kid on the block, because I was finally working with people that were trying to push at the level that I wanted to push at, and I had to step my game up and to hang with those guys, and that was awesome. You know, that was, like, exactly what I wanted.
I think that's one of the scary things about going indie. Like, I like collaborating, but I hate collaborating with people who, you know, aren't, I don't know what to say, but they're not there with you 100%. They're like kind of, they're not
flakes,
all on board,
flakes,
you know. And I've been flaking on projects too. It depends on the project, but that's one of the things I always get worried about is getting complacent with, all this is what I do and I'm good at it, and blah, 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 and getting stuck in your own head. And if you're not talking to other people, showing other people your work enough.
Yeah.
Bursting that bubble and actually seeing, oh shit, this is really crappy, and this person is doing something like 10 times better than what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think that's a trap you can kind of fall into.
Yeah,
not like you guys are going to fall into that. But just,
you know, it took us a month and a half, 2 months to figure out Shellraiser was the game we all wanted to work on together. You know, we threw around a lot of ideas, and you know, it took a while for me to get on board. And I knew when I came on board that it was like, I'm on board. Like, if I'm signing on to work with these guys, I've really got to go for it. And, you know, we threw around a ton of ideas before that. So sometimes you the person doesn't mesh with that gig, and it just doesn't mean that they're not going to give the 110%, and that's what you want, right? When you've got a small collaboration, you want everyone to be all in.
Yeah,
it's actually interesting, because in game jams, you get that, you get all of that, like,
it was
way more compressed.
Yeah,
like,
game jams are a good way to learn.
Yeah, for sure. And I would recommend anybody
can go.
Yeah, and I would recommend anybody do that too, because you find out in extremely short times whether somebody on your team is a flake or not.
like 10 minutes.
And it's interesting, because if you have a game jam team that where everybody is like super excited and like really come together, you can get an amazing game finished. But if there's a few people flaking out, then you have to, especially in the game jam, you have to be able to say, okay, those guys are going to flake out.
Yeah.
I know that. We're just going to work around it.
Yeah,
it's interesting in that way. So it kind of teaches you different things, I guess.
It would be kind of fun to do a game jam where you had fake game press and fake game releases at the end. And you kind of simulate the whole process, but in a condensed amount of time. And then everyone gets to see how much they would have made.
We got featured by Apple at the end of this game jam.
It's like a draw and a hat.
It's totally random.
Right? Your email to Touch Arcade did not read well.
Yeah. I liked Jake's idea. He had an idea for some sort of a game jam weekend thing where with different weird achievements. So, for example, you type all your code in, and you can only, if you press compile and there's a compile error, you have to like drink a shot.
Oh my god!
So you have to make
sure. I would be done that game jam like an hour in.
You have to like make sure your code is like proper before you hit compile, and it's like, you know, it'd be kind of funny. That would be a really quick one, but because it gets progressively worse, though, right? Like the more drunk you get, the more compile errors you're going to generate. But
we should mention Jake briefly, because he's leaving.
I know.
That's right.
So
he's leaving the city of Vancouver to return to the UK.
I remember meeting him the first actual meetup that was held between indies. Ryan Clark put it up with Jake, and Jake was this dude from Britain that was coming over.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to everybody with his British accent, and they're all like, who's this guy? He's obviously not from here. Says the Dutch guy. But anyway,
Dutch guy eating strawberry sandwiches.
Yeah.
This guy's not from around here.
But he was super excited, and he was super eager to get to know other indies, and also to bring them together.
And you could tell that from talking to the guy for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
He just
loves talking.
Yeah, and he gives when he doesn't ask for anything back.
Yeah,
you know, he just totally gives, and it's so amazing. Like, he's such a good.
Yeah.
I think he's imparted a big part of his spirit in the community here.
Yeah,
really changed a lot. It was easy to get 50 people together for the first indie meetup.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to grow up to what it is now. And the vibe that is, that's very open, and, you know, it's, and his openness.
Were there, like, any kind of grind pain things? We had, like, people who were showing up who were troublemakers or whatever?
No, not troublemakers, but, like, people who want to push products.
Yeah.
We got this great... and we want to talk about it. And in the beginning, they were like, "Oh, well, that sounds great." And then it really quickly,
you realize
all the Indians were like, "Who's this asshole?"
You can smell the snakes, like you can.
Yeah,
yeah.
But we had a friend of mine who knows his buddies came from EA, and he knew why they were there. He's like, "You guys are literally here to pilfer ideas.
Right.
We don't want you here because you're not here for that." And that's what they did. They went around and played everything, and then left and made a bunch of mobile games off the. And that's.
Did that actually happen to Full Indie?
Yeah, that's
really.
What happened. Not me personally, but
right.
That's what happened. EA sent like game idea headhunters, and they went around, and because the indies, like, we're like those seals, the monk seals that are so easy to kill, because we love everybody, we love everything, we show everybody everything. Here, our heart's right here on a platter, and like there is people that will just fucking yank it.
Yeah, but nowadays I think because it became such a tight-knit group, it's...
Well,
it's
cool now. And the RSVP thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, if you don't RSVP in the first day or two...
Day or two?
Yeah, yeah,
two hours.
It's like
two hours. 2 hours is full.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I got into the last one, then. I must have...
Well, you have to, so it's all right.
You probably got invited.
Any one that happens, you can probably get in fine. I wouldn't be too worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, they... It's interesting, though. Like, they... I think in the beginning, there was a few talks where... People were like, "Oh, who's this guy?" kind of thing, and then very quickly it changed, and now it's really turned viral in the last year and a half.
Yeah, last year and a half's been really good.
Yeah,
and, that book guy, guy just pitched that book. Oh, I just want to die laughing. That book guy. So he was a professional speaker, I think. I think Jake was scraping because no one had a talk.
Right.
So he grabs this motivational speaker guy.
It was just the wrong audience.
It was the wrong audience, and he pitched a book, and I think it broke something.
It's the same at the Game Jam, actually. There was the Game Jam. You weren't at that Game Jam. It was a global Game Jam.
Oh, there's a guy like that there.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was one of the radical guys, like the radical owners or something. And it was like a motivational speech of like, when you want to do something, you got to do it. And it's a great motivational speech, but we were all waiting for the damn theme to start.
We want
to
go.
And he's like, and for an hour, he's like, you have to do this. And we're like,
we already know that.
We know.
That's why we're here.
It's just a procrastination jam.
If you really want to do something, you got to listen to a guy yell at you for an hour. Okay.
It's around a moment.
The last, the only full indie game jam I've been at, that was the...
Yeah, this wasn't a full indie game jam. This was a global game jam.
Yeah.
But the full indie game jams, specifically, were because of that game, original global game jam, were like, no bullshit. You just sit down and start your stuff.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the full indie game jam quite a bit.
The recent one I went to was really, that was one of the best game jams I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everything was organized. There was food brought
into
the venue.
That was awesome.
all three meals were covered, which is just crazy.
And they were good too.
And it was just a really good vibe.
But the things that came out of that,
holy
cow!
Yeah, that's the thing. Like the
that
output
was your first game jam.
That was my first game jam.
The output was amazing compared to I think pretty much any other game jam.
Mm-hmm.
Like almost every game was something that looked like a legitimately playable thing.
It was so cool.
With good ideas.
And the space was
nice
too, just being in the back of the warehouse there.
Yeah,
and just it was open because the previous game jam they had at that building. The air conditioning wasn't turned on, and people split up between two rooms, and like the community kind of faded at that jam. Where that one, I just swung by for a visit with my daughter, and I could tell. I was like, "All right, Jake, you're doing good. Game jam's working out. It's all right. This will be a good one."
Yeah, it'll be sad to see Jake go.
He
was my Aikido teacher as well, actually, for a year and a half, and he's actually really good. Like the same thing he does with the game jams. He's very similar when he's teaching Aikido, and it's like super understanding, very slow, you know.
Almost kind of like hands off in a way.
Yeah.
He's not the kind of...
He lets you experience his stuff.
He's not like the kind of leader guy who's, you know, running around trying to force everything to happen.
It's weird. It just happens originally.
Yeah.
Like really organically.
Yeah.
But it happens.
That's
really
cool.
It's like
it'll be
a British talking Yoda instead of a Yoda talking Yoda.
It'll be very... I'm very sad to see him go, but I'm sure he'll be back here, and you know, we'll probably remain good friends anyway.
Yeah,
so
that's what the internet is for.
And he'll be in, what is it, Bridgeport or something like that. So he'll be on his own probably. So he'll probably be on Skype quite a bit.
Yeah.
We're like, hey, how are you guys doing?
And he works the oddest hours, so our day is going to be his day. So it'll work out fine.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think the community is going to be fine without him?
I think so now.
Because he's set up such good momentum and
a
really good crew.
And there's a few people that actually did step up and go, hey, yes, this is really cool, and I want to actually help organize this, and I'm sure it'll keep going. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, like the first few months, the management team changed a lot. It was always Alex and Jake, and a lot of people would come in and step off and come in and step off where, you know, Alan and Ola, they've been on for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's the management team is stabilized, so the people organizing it, they've kind of set the tone, and I don't see any of them leaving.
So it's not like regime change.
Yeah, and like, and Kimberly Vohl replaced Jake, and Kimberly Vohl organized the Global Game Jam. You know, she gives to the community a ton, too. So she's like, in all of Vancouver, if you had to pick the one person to replace Jake, I can't think of anyone besides Kimberly that would be as good, you know?
Well, she also loves doing it, it seems.
Yeah,
so
for some reason, she's just crazy about organizing.
Yeah, that's cool, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it'll change. It always does, and it always has, but it's in very, very good hands.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's hard to sort of break a community once it's established, once the culture's established.
Because
you can have a bunch of outsiders come in and try to peck holes in it, but, like, you know, there's not going to be too many weaknesses if everyone knows each other.
And especially if the outsiders come in and we're crazy about them, and they sit down and show their game off.
Oh, yeah.
Well, For me, like, I literally have my dream job. Like, literally. I do. And Jake is basically the guy that arbitrarily set up this meeting
where made it happen.
I have a dream job. Yeah. And I'm the envy of a lot of artists. And there's a lot of way better artists than I am. But they're like coming to me like, man, good job, man. I just want to be what you're doing. And I'm like, Christ, you draw circles around me. You're like so much better. Like, so I have this huge like man crush on Jake and like what he's done with
his hair is beautiful.
It's very flowing. He's very attractive.
Jake Burkett's hair is amazing.
Jake Burkett hair. Yeah, but really, like, artists get kind of like, we're actually dime a million. There's a ton of artists out there. That's why coders and designers will always pull in better wages. They will. And art, because artists, you can find it, you can get an art monkey for
it. It was funny, like, I never thought that.
I still don't think
really?
That.
Yeah, I always thought the exact opposite. But, like, I know a lot of programmers, I know no artists.
Yeah, but the thing
is, I know a few,
it's
but not
really hard to find a good artist.
Sure.
Like, an artist who can art direct their own stuff
for
an entire project.
Right? You need to be able to light the fire under your own ass, I think. And a lot of artists can't do that, because it's like...
Well, there's even the thing of people who are really ambitious, but don't know their own limits, and they're going to try way too hard, and like you were saying, you have like three brushes or whatever for, you know, you've like your own constraints on the art style, you know what you do well, you're not going to try and do something
out of the blue, right?
You're like, I know exactly what I want to do. That's rare. Like,
yeah,
especially, I don't know why, but I always get propositioned by the people who don't have any clue what they're doing. But a lot of artists come up to me at GDC and they want to work with me.
You look at their portfolio.
I get so excited, and then they show me the portfolio. I'm like, I think I could draw better than this if I wanted to. You know, like they feel horrible, but I don't know what to say to them. I'm just like, okay, well,
artists are also in a neat position because, like, Nick can say, I'm a good coder, and you really have to take his word for it, unless you know him, of course.
Yeah, but that's even that's totally relative, though.
Exactly, that's all relative.
Yeah.
An artist says, like, here's my stuff. It's like, that looks like garbage. And it's like, oh, you just punched a hole through my chest. But, like, literally, like, we actually wear our hearts on our sleeves, so to speak. Like, everyone
can... Well, even just because it's visual, so, like, people are going to process it so fast. It's like the comic book thing we're talking about. Whereas, like, if you were going to explain your code to someone, it's going to take you a while.
That's right.
You have a lot of opportunity.
The funny thing is, there's still different styles of coding.
Totally,
And certain things, certain styles might not match with certain other styles. And it's similar, except it'll just take a little bit longer to... see that, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, it's a lot more obfuscated, you know, and that's how I think you can kind of, you could potentially as a programmer fly under the radar of some project manager who doesn't really understand code.
Well, no, that's happened.
The artist.
All the time.
As a producer, you know, it's like, that's why I'm a religious enthusiast about Scrum. I love Scrum, and it's because you pick out the programmers who don't know what they're doing.
Can you explain Scrum for people like me who forgot what it was?
Scrum is an agile project management method where the team has a lot more ownership and self-direction and chooses their own work and estimates their own time.
It's also, it's basically, if you really think about it, it's all these small little indie teams rather than one giant team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have a programmer, an artist, and an audio guy, or whatever the task you're working on requires. But you have to work together.
Yeah.
Right. Quickly.
Yeah.
And
it's always go time, and you try and just make sure the team can solve their
own
problem.
How my brother's working right now. He's working at Riot. So
I've met some of the PMs at Riot, and we've actually, like, when Riot, before they got crazy big, I did, like, a conference call with one of those guys, and we talked Scrum, and it was all, like, religious, and we were all like,
yeah,
it's just funny, because, you know what,
velocity.
Yeah, it's always funny, because, like, you can say Scrum, and it either turns people way off,
right,
or it turns people totally on.
Well, isn't it a rugby thing?
Yeah, that's where it came from, but, like, the methodology itself. But then the funny thing is, we kind of use that on Shellraiser as well in certain ways.
It was a very unstructured Scrum, but it was...
Yeah, but it was fine. It worked okay.
Yeah.
It's mostly just, like, certain things that you just do.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you write all your tasks down, and you estimate how much it might take.
Yeah.
And then you just work on stuff. And then eventually, if you do that enough, if you do it with every task over a couple of weeks, you can actually see, this is about how many... difficulty points we get done every week, and then you can kind of see, oh, okay, maybe this we should. It's
a plan, but it's
all very iterative and changes all the time. But that's the cool thing about it.
Yeah, you're like, the cool thing is the ownership, though, where it's like,
yeah.
Nick is in charge of doing X, and at the end of the week, is X done? Well, Nick has to show it to everyone if it's done, and if it's not done, okay, well, we put it on the next one, because sometimes work doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm.
But if he does that 3 weeks in a row, guess whose name is on the chopping block?
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's completely transparent. You signed up for it. You put your name aside.
Yeah.
You said how long
it
would take.
And you didn't do your stuff.
And you didn't do your stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, as a project manager that, you know, before I learned how to program, you know, a programmer could be like, well, it's on the heap. And I'd be like, hey, it's on the heap. Cool. Okay. And I had no idea what I was talking about, right? So I couldn't make that call or even identify programmers that were working that way. And even other programmers, you know, you could talk your way out of a bad problem. But under Scrum, if your name's on it and you just can't get it done, it's...
Well, you're basically just working on production stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you have to get something that actually works.
Yeah.
You can't
be
esoteric, you can't be pie in the sky. No, it has to fucking work.
Yeah, and it has to be... Everyone has to see it.
Yeah.
And that's, like, getting it in the game and getting it working is all that matters, and that discounts for so much. And not just programmers, like anyone. Designers, da-da-da-da-da, anyone. It takes out the posers really fast.
Right,
yeah.
That's probably why people are scared of it.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
damn.
And then people...
the racket I've been running is...
Every time I say Scrum and I get all goofy-faced and people are like, oh, I hate Scrum, and I talk to them about their experience with it, inevitably...
They're doing it wrong.
They're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's somebody came in and they just took one thing. We have daily meetings.
Which
sucks. That's
like,
not Scrum.
And they think Scrum is actually everyone says what they're working on around in the circle.
And that's all they're doing.
And it's
Scrum.
Like, I don't... What are you doing? You're doing what? Like, I don't care about... Why are we doing this? Like, that's why people have it bad.
Yeah.
Because we did, like, faux Scrumming at some of the bigger studio I worked for. And it was, like, just a flop. Like, really, it's like... But it would make more sense if we did it that way, so...
Yeah, like, it's... It's the thing everyone thinks that Scrum is the daily stand-up meeting, and it's, you know, I think it's 10% of why Scrum works. And everyone will be like, well, we do the daily stand-ups, what else do you do? How's your backlog? I don't know. What's the velocity? What's velocity? And it's like, okay, well,
you're not doing
Scrum. And so it's...
But it is funny that Scrum works because they turn a big studio into a bunch of little fast, agile ones.
And teams that work.
And teams that work.
And teams that... And it really... The funny thing I've seen at different companies where I've used Scrum is you can take a team of really junior guys and girls that are really passionate and work as a team together, and they will double the performance of a senior team.
Yeah.
And simply their cohesion as a team. You know, when people always say, like, well, how did you and Jesse and Nick work together? It's like, it's the easiest project I've ever worked on. You know, like, we all got along. And, you know, when there were disagreements, it was about the game, what was best for the game.
It was about the actual objective.
There was no ego involved.
It's not like deep-seated hatred over Nick's strawberry sandwiches. Or
All right, bottle number three.
Oh, my gosh.
Impressive.
So much wine.
But, like, those discussions were never...
You
know, it was no ego involved.
It was
pretty much a bottle per hour, I think.
Yeah, well, that's
that's
how we roll.
This changes after the serious lack. There is no ego at all. Like, there's not no one's
factor probably decided lack of ego.
Yeah, there you go. There's a serious lack of ego that made it work so well, I think.
Yeah, and we just, you know, when we discuss things until there's a good resolution, like, it was a week and a half ago on the weekend, Nick and I had, like, an hour long text message conversation talking about, you know, like, what are we doing with the purchases? What are we doing with new levels? What should we put on, get working on first? But it was always like, I think this. Well, I think this. And we just go until somebody says, what about this? Right.
Oh, right. And
perfect.
It's just defining where you are and not taking offense if somebody else is at a different spot.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, but And then the funny thing is, you both start sort of defending your own point of view, and then eventually somebody pitches something else, and then eventually you actually find out you were actually talking about the exact same thing.
That happens so many times that I'm like, Well, we've been like literally arguing. Like, I use the term arguing loosely, but we were literally arguing for the last hour, and we were trying to say the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Or just find that one solution to the problem, you know?
Sure,
that's the thing, is you just talk it out. But you know, compared to other projects that I've worked on, I've only ever had that cohesion with the team one other time, and that was on Company of Heroes, where like the leads team was just, we just synced, and you know, we get in the zone and we just go for it, and and you can't plan for that. You know, I was talking with Alex Bostrov about that, and he's like, "How do you get that sync?" And I'm like, "I don't know."
It's actually funny
when
because
you get it, you keep it.
You know what's interesting? I find with indies in that respect is that getting that sync is easier because you can totally choose the people you work with.
Yeah.
If you're in a big company, you basically get forced to be on a certain team, and it can gel and it cannot gel.
Cross your fingers that you work with someone you don't hate.
Like, and actually, like, you know, the way we work together was like his company Shane has his own company, and we have our own company, and Jen has her own company, and we basically all collaborated almost in like a movie style, where it's like, hey, we're working on this project, you, and you are all part of this.
We're going to use ILM for this.
It's cool. And I'm actually wondering,
it's like a component game object model.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, include this library, you know?
I worked for Nick for like about, I think it was like 2 or 3 months, and Nick's advice to me was, after we set up, you should just quit and make your own company, and I'll just hire you again. That's like the advice my boss is giving me. He's like, seriously, this is what you should do. And it makes...
It's interesting because it makes links like that so much more... It's like what you were talking about earlier. It's like a weak pointer. Rather than you can go, okay, you know, for this game, this configuration is better. And nobody takes offense because it's all their own company.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what? There might be other projects going on where they're fine and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll really work that well, but like, it seems to work for the movie industry, even though probably a lot of people are not happy with that either. But
I was actually in movies before I got into part of everything. I was doing like
you have some horror stories about that, too.
Horror stories. There's some good stories about movies. But yeah, like it is set up exactly like that. Our current situation, except that instead of a company of one, there's a company of 40, 80, 90.
Well, that's the whole difference of it, right?
Yeah,
like you have companies that
are
large.
It isn't a company; it's you.
It's
physically. I know that Ninja Robot Dinosaur is Shane Neville. I know that. I don't question like, well, how big is his office? I know that Shane Neville is this company.
Who do you contact for HR?
It's like your Clark Kent Superman thing. That's why I'm kind of seeing all these things pop up. Jen Lewis is Maple Syrup Sound. She's the only one there.
Mm-hmm.
Jen Lewis is Maple Syrup Sound. Like that's literally it. Which is cool because
But
it's
something
it
that
really
people. It's something that some people scoff at. I think it's people who don't really understand it. They're like, "Oh, you have a company? Well, yes, but it's me."
Yeah.
Oh.
Really,
the only reason you're a company is because of legal benefits and tax benefits
and
whatever. You know.
Exactly.
But I really like your metaphor of Clark Kent Superman, because it is a little bit like that, where you're your own self, but then you have this entity that kind of represents you.
And
it forces you to put your business hat on.
You're
just yourself, and it's like, well, you know, the business, I do my taxes every month, and I, you know, do my finances and make sure everything's lined up, and you force yourself to do that when you have a business, and it's a good thing to get into, really thinking about what you're doing as a business, and it's not the funnest part, but it's an important part.
It's why I don't think I'll ever do it. To tell you the truth, that's definitely why I'll never do that.
Yeah, there's definitely a little bit of work involved, but I don't know.
There's a bio, like, I think the thing that bothers me about Shellraiser is that, like, the only thing that people actually physically see, like the layman looking at Shellraiser, thinks that I just built everything. Because, like, literally, that's all you're really seeing. But that really, really bothers me, because people think, like, well, then I'll just do that. I'll just draw this game. You're like, no, you can't just draw a game.
Yeah.
You understand, like,
my art would be nothing. It would be a bunch of still images on a DeviantArt account that doesn't get any hits at all. Like, literally, that's literally what it would be. But when you start collaborating with people, like, you have this chance to make something super awesome that you could never do on your own. A lot of developers, they swear by working on their own, and I feel really bad for them.
Right. Well, some people can do it, like...
Oh, yeah.
But they... I generally find that they beat themselves up a lot, like... Konjac, however you want to pronounce it, like, the guy who did Noi 2 Love 2, and...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What's the amazing game that he's working on? The one that's like a Super NES era action adventure.
No, I don't know Noi 2 Love 2, but that's the only one I have.
Oh, it's so good. It's like a girl mechanic, and she's a giant wrench.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, that guy, he's killing himself.
No, and but he does
right?
every single element of the game.
Yeah.
But you follow him on Twitter, and he's a bit better now, but he's just constantly rag on himself. You know, because he's holding himself to this incredible standard, and I don't understand, like, he's entered the IGF a few times, and, like, I think people look at it, and I think they think that it's like, okay, this is like an SNES game made by a team of maybe
60.
10
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So, whatever, we've seen that. But it's one guy. Like, he's literally working harder than everyone else here.
You know what I found? Nobody cares about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's only other indie developers and only other developers that know the guy care about that.
Or
other people who have done solo games.
Sure.
Like,
well, or if you can turn it into a news story, which, to be honest, like with the Quarry, there was a little bit of that where we would get news stories and be like, two guys made this.
That's cool.
In 2 years, you know, and you can kind
of
use
that. You can get some leverage out of that.
But it's not, the novel's gone now.
Yeah, but then
everyone's a two-man team.
But one man is, I think, there's still some novelty there. I think if he was more comfortable with himself, he would be sort of selling himself a bit more, but I think he just doesn't want to sell himself at all. Right? He just...
Yeah.
But yeah, your point is well taken for sure. That
I mean, the thing is, like, it can be a news story, but then again, some news agency or some news outlet needs to pick it up, and then people actually have to read it. So it has to become
totally.
A pretty big viral news story for it to be actually worthwhile for the guy.
And
I don't know. Like, from my personal experience, like, going indie, actually, it's almost like putting a magnifying glass in yourself and seeing what skills are you good at and what skills are you really not good at, and then finding the people who can complement those skills.
Well, that's...
And I think if you do that, the end result will be so much better than you could ever do yourself.
I totally agree with you, but I still do the thing where I beat myself up for not being able to do all the things that I...
Sure, I mean, I would love to be able to draw like Jesse. I would love to be able to like to.
But it's kind
of... power.
I love
tweaking.
I know what you mean.
Shane was tweaking the
lips. I would love
there.
To do everything myself, but in the end, it's like... I don't know, at some point...
Well, but the thing is, like, you have to specialize. And I think it's totally... fine to let yourself specialize in one area and like, I don't specialize in this whatever, in art or whatever it is, and I don't know, I love collaborating with people who are extremely talented, because it's just it's that kind of thing where Jesse was talking about being a huge fan of someone.
Yeah.
I love working with people who I'm a huge fan of, you know, it's just like, because you get art assets in and you're like, this is amazing.
Cool.
You know,
yeah,
so like,
that.
I'm so excited now, I'm going to put this in the game. But I've always felt slightly guilty about that for some reason. I don't know why.
Why?
I don't know why.
Like, do you feel guilty because
it's
you
like
can't
I should
do that kind
it's,
of art?
I guess,
or?
I feel like I should be doing at least mock-ups of art or something, but I'm like waiting for the artist to do stuff or something. But really, like, especially if the project is being designed by the artist, that makes sense, where it's like, okay, this is gonna I need to wait for this to come in, but...
Yeah, interesting.
If anyone's waiting for my stuff, I'm not doing my job right. that's kind of my, what I swear by now. But
interesting. Like, most of the time when I've... Well, I know I can't do art, I just go to... Like, that's the thing. I guess, I don't know, like, I don't feel guilty when Jesse actually puts art in, and I'm like, I should have been able to do that or something. I don't feel that at all. Like, it's like, I know I can't do it.
Right.
And he can do it. And he puts it in. And every time he draws something, the end result is so much better than I could even expect. So
I
was like, sweet. Right? So,
I
don't know.
I watch, like, making up stuff all the time when I'm working to motivate myself. I just love it.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the... I watch a lot of James Cameron making of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, so, and, like, James...
I love that stuff.
He can do everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He can sit in the audio room with a room full of audio professionals and be like, make the breathing louder. I can't hear my hero. And they're like, oh, my God, you're amazing, James Cameron! And they all tweak the knobs.
In Aliens, he painted a picture of... Ripley in the lifter.
In the lifter, yeah. Well, and he
fighting
created
the Alien Queen.
He
designed the Alien Queen. And I look at that, I'm like, well, yeah, if you have a complete vision of something, you should be able to convey in exact detail what you're looking for.
There's a lot of these
But there's a lot of different ways to approach that. Like, there are other directors who are like, I just have this angle on it, and I work with these people, like Cronenberg collaborates with.
Yeah.
A lot of the same.
You are
people.
Referring to, you know, James Cameron, the most profitable film director of all time.
Actually, I think I understand better what you're saying now, because the one thing I do beat myself up for sometimes is, like, I wish I had that vision of what this game should be.
Yeah.
That part, I wish I really went, like, yes, this is the game I want. Like,
if you could close your eyes and picture it exactly.
And this is what it needs to be. And I find more, well, actually, almost all the time, I have to actually... talk to you. I have to talk to Jesse. I have to talk
to
Shane.
Build some stuff
and actually come up with ideas and shoot ideas off each other in like an upward spiral almost. And that's when I actually realized, oh, okay, this is what the game is. I can't come up with that by myself somehow, and I wish I could. Because I have so many notebooks and like half baked ideas, and then I just ditched them. And I was like,
everyone talks about prototyping. Like, okay, we'll go prototype something and iterate, but it's like. I'm getting better at prototyping all the time, but my brain should be faster at that. It should be able to imagine things.
Yeah.
I haven't been developing that skill at all. I haven't actually been trying to train myself to just picture a game in complete detail or as much detail as I can muster enough to get a sense of it. I'm more just, I want to go code it right now.
Right.
I want to go, and it's like...
And Unity trains you to do that, because it's so easy to just...
Yeah, and it's not bad, because it's so fast. Like, you can pretty much in a couple hours see, okay, there's that thing.
But,
it's kind of a bit of masturbation in a way, where it's like, I'm really good at coding this thing, but, like, that doesn't prove anything in terms of design. And what
are you
working
on that all by yourself? In, like, isolated state?
Because
what I find is, like, if I... try and make a prototype, and I don't know, your own brain is almost limited to whatever you think the game's going to be, and you never, I find it really hard to come up with an actual creative idea. Some people are really, really good at it and go like, oh, this should be that or that, and then, but my skill is to actually kind of boil it down and actually try and make it,
right?
And then I find that is limiting at the same time, so I love having somebody else there
who goes, what about this?
And you're just like,
My sister
actually
do that, but
but it sparks creativity rather than, you know, or maybe that idea is so crazy that you're like, oh, well, I can't do that, but I could do that, and that's actually really cool. And so that's
It pulls you in different
directions. I find it really hard to make a prototype on my own. It's almost impossible. But if you work with other people that have cool ideas, then
I really like working on solo projects. It's just it takes a long time, because I've been a designer and producer for most of my career, and I started working on my art 5 years ago. I am barely competent as an artist, and I'm incompetent as a programmer, but I can put enough glue and sticks and duct tape in there to make things work. But I still really love that, for that exact same idea, where I've got something in my head, and I want to see how to make it. The hardest thing that I find problems with, though, is because my abilities as an artist and a programmer aren't there yet, the ideas that I come up with are ones that I still have to be able to execute on. And so it's like, I have to finish a game or even like build a prototype.
So I almost feel like the opposite. I feel like I could execute a lot of ideas very quickly. And I actually have the kernel of a good idea, or feel like I have the kernel of a good idea. But I don't have the ability yet to just, in my head, extrapolate it over the course of, okay, I can see that, not even to extrapolate the entire game, but just enough, like, okay, I can see that this would stem off and become
why
cool.
Why is it fun?
This
why
would
is
stem
this
off.
Compelling?
Just,
what's
I have this
experience?
One idea, it's really cool. It could go in any one of, like, 128 directions.
Yeah.
I'm more of the kind of, like,
128, that's an interesting programmer.
Exactly.
Like, random number.
Or perhaps 256. Perhaps.
Yeah.
But that was exactly
like you, I think.
I think you have more of a,
you're a designer too, but like you're also quite a programmer, right? Like you probably think
I don't think I'm as much of a programmer as you are, like, but it'll be.
It just sounded familiar.
Yeah, like, no, but like, yeah, definitely,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, and for me, that was my job for 12 years.
Right.
Was taking ideas, visualizing
mm-hmm.
them, pitching them, getting people behind, leading a team in the same
yeah.
direction, and being able to explain that idea time and time again,
mm-hmm.
And you know, on teams of, you know, 110 people down to 5 people, and so that skill for me is very practiced
because
mm-hmm. I've just done it a ton of times. So.
So what is it like to have these godly powers?
To me, it's not godly. It's just
right.
like it's the
yeah.
tuning gene,
yeah.
right? You know,
yeah.
like if you spend.
No, but I mean, like when you're thinking about a game, can you actually internally like just sort of be like, okay, what will this turtle be over here? And
I need my notebook.
This okay, you need to actually like.
I need
sketch.
To write it down, and a lot of times it's you know like why is this interesting, and you know. The amount of pages I went through on Shellraiser of, like, why isn't the shooting fun? You
mm.
know, and I would just be like, what games are fun when it shoots? Why is this happening? Like, because I made all the guys one hit, one kill, and that was horrible. It was horrendous, right? So I was like, okay, well, that's how most shooters work,
yeah,
so
yeah,
I can't do that.
You would kill them before they'd even pop in. And
yeah,
look
yeah. So, I had to, basically, I was looking at all the different things that had worked in the past and why it
mm-hmm.
doesn't work, and so I do a lot of writing out. I do a lot of drawing, trying to think about where my brain is working while my hands are working,
mm-hmm.
and just trying to decipher it, and then just, you know, just feel, you know, but when it's at the very early stages, you know, when they just showed me, you know, Turtle with guns, I was like, well, we got to make a role-playing element around this.
Like,
we actually had this saying, like, you know, me and Jesse, we'll just put it in, make a prototype, and then we'll just give it to Shannon, he makes it fun.
That's literally pretty much the entire game.
Yeah, we'll just give it to Shannon, he makes it fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, that's like confidence in the people you're working with. You know,
yeah.
It's like, we'll give it to Shannon, it could be the worst element ever, but he will make it fun somehow.
Yeah. But it's a self-defeating thing, too, because a lot of times I'll have an idea, and if I can't think it's fun before I start building it, I won't make it happen.
Oh,
yeah.
And that's why I like prototyping a lot, and that's why I actually, because I can program now and I can build things, I can be like, it should be fun, and then I build it and it's not fun, and
mm-hmm.
then I've still got something running, so I can look for those little nuggets that are fun and extrapolate those further.
I remember hearing advice about writing, and it was just write anything. Just write something on the
mm-hmm.
page, because then you can look at it
and
be like,
and
oh,
yeah,
I hate
yeah.
that.
Totally.
I would change this, and then at least
yeah.
you have something there, you
yeah.
know, like
yeah.
the one
that was actually
irritation that starts the whole process, you know.
That was actually kind of what we tried to do with the game as well. We would just put shit in
yeah.
and see
yeah.
if it works.
Yeah.
And go from there.
Yeah, a lot of me, like, my art structurally, if you see how I draw, I drew an insanely loose rough, but so rough, my brain can actually try to think it looking good in a couple ways, because it's so bad. It's, like, really, really, really rough, right? And it's funny the way that Shane, when you're talking about visualizing games, like,
mm-hmm.
I can remember, I have a very odd memory, but I've actually been, my mother says I've been drawing since I was 2 years old. And I actually remember that when games became a big deal to me, I remember I would draw all these sheets of paper, and I'm, like, really, really young, and I would draw the game cartridge cover in the top left, and I would draw, like, a screen of what's happening in
nice.
The game, and then, like this is ridiculous, but this is what I thought in my super young kid brain, how people made games. Well, you draw the cartridge cover, and then you draw what's happening.
That reminds
me. And you put it in the cartridge.
And then you just
fold it.
I think it's folding. There's a lot of folding involved. That's literally and I'm just a giant kid cartoon. Like, I literally am. Like, when I see myself work and stuff, it's like, I'm like, Jesus, I haven't aged at all. I've actually taken my printing.
That's,
like,
that's a strength, I think.
Because
it's hard, like. I find
disconnect.
Growing old,
yeah.
there's like this tendency to get a bit cynical.
Sure.
It's,
oh, it's so easy now. It's
yeah.
so easy to get cynical.
Finally, it's easy to get cynical. like, you know, like someone like me actually like was successful doing indie stuff, and now I'm like kind of doing some contract work. And I'm reflecting, like, why am I doing that?
This isn't like you got into it, right?
Like, yeah. why? Like it's good.
Sure.
I enjoy it.
This is like consulting with Shane, right?
Yeah.
You know, but usually goes the other way, you know,
yeah,
usually, and it's like a confidence thing, and,
yep.
and there's a bunch of issues around it.
Well,
but,
and you're in the boat, too, where you haven't shipped, like, an infinite
yeah.
ammo, like, you've
yeah.
done smaller games,
yeah.
And you've collaborated on a lot of stuff, that
yeah.
you know, and you've had the Marion problems as well,
yeah.
where it's been restarting a lot, so it's I think for you, it's really validating to work on a contract gig where you know it's going to
yeah.
come out, And there's...
Well, I don't know if it's going to come out, but I know that somebody's going to look at it and say they like it or don't like it.
Right.
And for some, and someone's going to pay me a paycheck. And
yeah.
for some reason that feels reassuring. It's like kind of the indie thing where you've gone so far off the map in terms of structure that, like, just any kind of structure is reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, someone's going to...
Yeah.
Maybe they don't know anything about games, but they're going to say if they like it or not. You know? They're going to say something about it.
Yeah.
Which is weird. Yeah.
That's what I got caught up in 2011 is, like, 2010, I was like, I'm going to go indie, and I'm going to make a Flash game, and millions of people are going to play it, and I'm going to sell a whole bunch of t-shirts. And this is what happened. I made a Flash game, and millions of people played it, and I sold 3 t-shirts.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay. So I had this huge defeat, and then I was like, well, I've got a family, I've got a wife and a daughter, we live in the most expensive city in North America, I've got to make some money.
Yeah.
And I went into this, like, crazy consulting dive, and I just started taking contract work, and I came out of 2011, and I was like, one of my things, I gotta ship more games. I gotta do more games where I'm part of the game. I'm not just a contractor working on it. And then Nick walked in, but it was like for a year and a half of my indie, my 2.5 years as an indie developer, I was just doing contract work and making prototypes that got scrapped. You know, and so like I totally know exactly where you're coming from because it feels so validating. It's like, oh, my prototype sucks. Someone likes my tower defense role playing game. What am I going to do? Hey, Shane, do you want to come write for Battlestar Galactica, the MMO? Yes, I do. I'll come over and do that. You know, and so you get this instant validation, and you know the work is going to get out there, or somebody's recognizing it, where...
At least someone is looking at it.
You can
pretend like you're doing a good job because they like it.
Yeah. And the money comes in, so you feel
like... And
there's
some money coming in, you feel like you're doing something useful. You know?
I think it... It's sometimes just really nice to be told what to do.
Yeah,
totally.
It's easy to follow that.
Nick and I do this all the time. What should we do? I don't know. What do you want to do? What do you want to do? It's like let one of us make the decision.
It's
like, let's see, what should we do? This. Okay, cool.
Don't talk to me, you bunch of idiots.
Yeah. But talking about, like, visualizing what the game is going to be, it's actually a really interesting concept, a really interesting subject, I think, because it is usually what stops me from starting a prototype. Because I can't actually visualize what the game is going to be.
Right.
But I want to start a prototype before I actually know what I want to get to.
Right.
But the funny thing is that now with ShellRaiser, especially actually, what worked really well were visual design docs. So we were actually going to do a talk about this at PAX,
PAX Dev.
But what worked really well is, like, somebody would have an idea and we would, like, talk about it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's kind of cool. And then Jesse would take it and actually put it in a sort of cartoon setting. And, you know, the turtle will be in the image and would have, like, actually on my dev blog, if you go to our dev blog on slickentertainment.com, click on dev blog, there's a ton of little images that just sort of show the emotion of the turtle when it's doing the action. Like, stepping on a mine, he just goes like, oh, what's going on, right? Like, and you just see, like, oh, okay, I understand that.
That's what I want the player to feel, is what the turtle's expressing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get that expression that you would never get in an 80-page design doc. Because in a design doc does it say, player shoots the enemy and then feels remorse.
Turtle reels back and
you get the action maybe, but you don't get the emotion. You know, and that's that emotion. You just immediately read it. You subconsciously read the emotion.
And with that, it's interesting because I'm similar to you. Where you're like, okay, where is this game going to go? You see that image and you instantly understand.
Right.
The entire universe of that particular game, and it's really interesting. It focuses.
It's funny how much art can really
totally
change
so
a project.
Cool.
And like, if you're looking at it,
for me, it's great. Like, for some people, it's music. For some people, it's like, for me, it's like something visual just really resonates with me in my brain. I guess.
And I think a big thing too is the thing I learned over the years as a producer is knowing where your core is in the game. And I did this constantly on ShellRaiser, is like, we're a shooter. Like, let's not deviate from the core, because it's really easy to add features that weren't shooter features and things like that. And so it's the same idea when you're concepting about the game and going at the high level. It's like, what is the game? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the core interaction? Is it a, you know, a platforming jumping game? Is it an exploration game? What are the core experiences and emotions you want the player to feel? And when you have that core, you kind of use it as your compass, your design compass,
right.
to say, like, you know, it's a shooter. Okay, well, we're tapping treasure chests. Why do we do that? Why don't we shoot them? It's a shooter. And it's like you constantly have to remind yourself. And it's the same way in a story. They'll have the theme. You know, Jaws, for example, the theme is overcoming your fear of water. The main character, that's what the movie's really about. It's got a giant shark, and the shark represents his fear of water. But that compass constantly points the story back. And, you know, you can do the same thing in games with your genre and your core mechanics. Is you use that as a compass to guide you when you're designing.
What's really kind of funny is, like, Shane gathered a lot of stuff from the way I approached drawing a lot of the design docs. And when he said that, I literally had no idea what he was talking about. He was like, well, see, this is actually what the player's feeling. And I've always just done what I do and not really think twice about it. It's like, well, this is just how I do it. I throw this up on a mine, he's sad, and I just, this is how I draw the whole thing. And the best part about art, and one of the best parts about Shellraiser, I think, is that people take it in totally different ways. I think it was our Touch Arcade video where the one guy's like, I don't know, man, you got cannons and you're like destroying aboriginal goblins have bows. Like, this is colonial shit. You are going. And he extrapolated this amazing story that made me sound like some kind of like, it made me sound like the artist was insane. But I was like, that is awesome. And so I was just sad about that, but the way that, like, I didn't know that my art was resonating with Nick or with Shane, but like, it, like, we were getting stuff done, so I'm like, okay, good, I must be doing my job alright. But
right.
The fact that it works on so many, it helps doing stuff. And it's like,
yeah.
What, to get your artist to draw all your gameplay elements, if he doesn't like doing that, you hired the wrong guy. Like,
mm-hmm.
artists should like doing what they do. And
mm-hmm.
it's like sixth second nature to me, even today. I was insanely hungover, and I still drew stuff for our dev. It was
his birthday yesterday.
Yeah. It was my birthday.
There we go.
He has an excuse. I have an excuse. It's a Tuesday. What's wrong with you guys?
Yeah. But after that, you know, even on my own solo projects, I draw everything now.
Yeah,
you know, it's mostly stick figures, but it's...
Yeah, you are getting really good, though.
No, it's my sticks look like stick figures. It is amazing.
It's so good.
But
they finally look like real stick figures.
You know, honestly, it could fit into a game of Hangman.
I know you were drawing
like,
stick figures, and they were all circles. And,
yeah.
And polygons.
Horrendous. But, it does. It helps me visualize more than just, like, writing out 1, 2, 3, 4, or circles with arrows attached.
And
like
a lot of that is just having the courage to...
To look shitty.
To suck.
That is totally it. But
yeah.
If you're surrounded by guys that are okay with working with you, you don't need to worry about that. It's like there's
mm-hmm.
no curve.
Yeah.
And that helps the whole process too, because you can really feel safe to experiment, and then experiments lead to awesome stuff every so often, right?
Yeah. And there were lots of experiments that, you know, were just insane, but they all worked out. You know, like, a lot of crazy stuff.
You know, in general, though, I find that the projects I liked working on most in my entire career, not just, Shellraiser was really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked working, on Scrap Metal and N Plus as well. But, like, at Relic, we worked on Dawn of War. And the funny thing was, there wasn't a lot of concept. There was actually quite a lot of concept art, but like for gameplay elements, there was this one designer who's actually now at Blizzard, Jay Wilson. He was very visual in the way he would explain stuff to you, and just making it visual, making it like, this is what it needs to look like. This is, you know, that resonates.
Yeah.
And when you get that, people are on board, and people go the extra length and go the extra mile or whatever you call it, and it works.
Yeah. Right. Well, the whole objective of the design doc is to just make sure people understand what's supposed to be happening. And if you can do that with a picture, where it's like,
why is
this interesting? Why is this exciting? That's
totally.
All you need to communicate. And so that's really the whole
idea. The talk we're doing at PAX is actually called Design Docs Suck, isn't it?
Well, no, that's the first
line.
First line of the description.
That's why there's going to be three people in the audience.
Right. And they won't be designers, they'll all be artists.
How can I get rid of those fucking designers?
Yeah. A thing that Shane mentioned that was like, when we saw a problem element in our game, it was on four quick drawings, and Shane could tell, like, guys, this is too big, scrap it.
Yeah.
And you, like Shane was saying, you can't fish through a 200 Word document and find the element that is really your game's problem. But you can if it's a bunch of stupid drawings.
It's so
I
easy.
Humans are visually driven. Like, so, just, like we're,
we are. We have to be.
We
didn't evolve from cavemen because we could read. I promise you that. It's because we spotted that leopard hiding in the bushes and we went the other way, you know.
So it's just a faster way to communicate information. Yeah.
And exactly. A lot of things that...
It's actually funny how unskilled most of us are in actually communicating in pictures. Like, I'm horrible at it. But, like, you know, you got to find the people that are actually good at it.
Yeah. I found a lot of the game was actually built on instinct, though. And I really think that you can actually feel that. Like, it was like... I think this feels good. But then Shane's like, yeah, it does feel good. Don't worry, guys. Like, Shane was there, and he's like, okay, I'll tweak this, and we'll pull it this way, and push it this way, and it's good. But, like, initially, the whole thing was just gut. Like, and now we have minds. Like, minds, yeah. And let's make it so it's player toggleable that we can, like, run. Yeah, that'll work. It's a good idea. Like, it was all just gut reaction.
Now let's award coins if you run, because you're kind of crazy if you do.
Totally. Cool. Bonus stuff. Like, it was all just these gut... And it feels very primal. I'm an insane sucker for games like Xenoclash, for example. Those like three brothers in Chile or Brazil.
Yeah.
One of the their game is so lovable to me because it is literally just them just building, like as an artist, their stuff is ugly. It's good art and it's consistent, but really it's. Everything's a little bit off, and it doesn't really work. But it is so lovable. I'm just in love with that game because it just like works. And I feel that Shellraiser was created the same way because it's just like I love the turtle. I love drawing orcs and all this crazy garbage. And it's I want to get the same feeling through like visually anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we all had to love the game to make it, and that was that's a big part of why it worked.
Yep.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I think that's a good place to end this podcast, which is almost at 3 hours.
Hey, look at that. Jesus. Wow.
Is that a new Infinite Ammo record?
No.
No? It's
the longest. We have a few 3-hour podcasts.
Well, I know you have a few, but...
Yeah.
Wow, I'm glad that we're there.
Yeah, I don't think we're hitting the record.
Yeah. 3 hours, 3 bottles of wine.
Okay.
Not too bad.
Not too bad.
Usually at the end I ask if you guys have any advice for people who are starting out. But I think we actually sort of covered that.
Kind of go over that.
Yeah, like some eyes, like quick, Shane?
If you wanted to go over that.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I'm good.
Yeah, we're good.
Ship a game.
Yeah.
Actually, that's
just ship
just
a game.
Get
ideas are crap. Execution is worth its weight in gold. Like, it's all about execution, not ideas.
Yeah. It's much better to, like, go out in a small market like iOS or Flash where you can make a game in a month and really realize if you are good and where you can improve. Because if you make a crappy Flash game and put it on Flash game license and no one bids, you have to get better at what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the best lesson that you can learn. It's much better to do that than spend 2 years on a downloadable PC game that then sucks. And then you're just like, oh.
Slightly off topic, do you think it's worth going to schools that could supposedly teach you game design and development? Or do you think it's better to just get practical experience if possible?
It depends on who you are as a person.
Mm.
Do you need someone to kick your ass into gear? Go to school. If you can do this on your own, you are autodidactic, I believe the word is, then just stretch out on the
That's
net.
Quite the word. Yeah. 3 bottles of wine.
Yeah, thank you.
It was in the indie, Arizona Indie House, and it was the analogy of you teach a class, and it's like 30% are total disasters, 30%, they're going to succeed no matter what they do, and then in the middle, you've got, you know, the 40% that can go either way. Mm. And that was exactly the numbers that I came up with my own teaching experience.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, you just see the top stars. You're like, you guys, you don't need to be game designers.
Yeah.
Like, whatever you do, you can do it, you know? And I'm glad you came to school, and you guys are going to really excel because of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones at the bottom, it's like, you know what? You could show up on time. You could do your work. You know, the getting them to have a basic work ethic is really hard. And then it's the middle is who you're really teaching.
Okay.
You know, you want the 30%. Hopefully to rise above because you're teaching them, but that 40% in the middle, if you can push more of them towards the upper echelons, that's kind of, for me as a teacher, that was always the goal. But but the thing is most of that 30%, they did not need to go to game design school.
Yeah.
They could have just spent that year making Flash games or iPhone games or, you know, making freeware games and just getting it out there and shipping because you're going to learn so much and just really engaging with the community. If you're in the middle of nowhere, you got to go to a city where there's a community and you can actually chat with people. Internet can help, but
not not that much, you think? Like, you think the personal connection...
There's so many examples. Like, look at Chevy, you know?
Right.
Chevy Ray Johnson from the middle of nowhere was a wrecking ball before he came to Vancouver. Now he's a bigger wrecking ball, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't say it's impossible.
Yeah.
But to me, like, community and being able to learn from people is really, really key. And, you know, it's easier if you can make a face-to-face relationship with someone.
Yeah. And art side, an artist is allowed to draw weird, but they need to be able to draw tons and fast. Like, that's really all the advice I have. Like, you're allowed to be stylistic. Just make sure you're faster than everybody else. That is literally how I got my job. That's all I can really say to this. The guys that draw really slow, like, sorry. It's like mobile stuff. You want to be quick. And you're still allowed to draw kind of crap. But just draw lots. There's a saying, I think it's like a mooring, a docking book. If you can't tie knots, tie lots.
Yeah,
that's kind of my approach to art right now, and I think it's worked thus far, so I'm going to keep at it.
Yeah, if it's my turn to say what we should do.
Just drawing blanks.
No, I mean, the problem is there's so many things I think you should do.
Mm-hmm.
Like working at a big company, I think is a good way to get started, but the only reason is because you can learn more in a shorter time than you could possibly ever learn yourself.
Because you don't have to learn from mistakes.
I don't have much experience with schools because when I started doing this stuff, there were no schools.
Yeah, there were no, yeah.
So I had to all learn it myself. And you can really see the people who actually succeeded.
Before education?
Yeah. The people who actually succeeded when I was starting to get into games is that every single person that I know from that time wanted to learn the stuff by themselves, and they did. And it's like the want to learn it is the key. Like
right.
if you don't really want to learn game design,
you're
never gonna
screwed.
You're never gonna do it. If you're like, oh, I kind of want to learn game design, but you know, Lost is on TV.
Yeah.
Well, fuck Lost on TV. Seriously, turn up. Like, quit your cable. Quit your everything. Like, what do you want to do? You want to do game design? Learn game design.
Yeah.
That's the key, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Be aggressive in what you want to learn. And honestly, there's a lot of hard work involved.
Yeah.
And you have to get through that. But that is a lesson in itself for making games, because making games is 90% really hard work and 10% fun. You know?
Yeah.
And hopefully, the hard work is actually fun. And that's probably the key to it, and that's why I totally agree with your thing of going,
well,
make a game and finish it.
Yeah.
Because just the finishing part, like, however small it is, the finishing part is so hard.
Oh, fuck.
You do that once, and you're like, yes.
The starting part is so easy.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
You start so many games and never finish the whole bunch.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if you start something, finish it. And then the next time, it's easier to finish it.
Yeah.
And then by project 10 or whatever, how far you are, the finishing part isn't the problem anymore. But that is usually the hardest problem. Get that solved first, and then you can go nuts on what you want to do.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if that's any advice for like the beginner. Like,
a good example of that is at VFS when I would teach my first class. I would always ask at the very beginning, okay, how many people here have made a game and released it before? And it doesn't matter if it was, you know,
like a prototype board game.
Or, you know, you put out a flash game, or you made something in high school and your friends played it and you gave it to them on floppy disks. How many of you did it? And 100% of the people that put up their hands were honor students at the end of the year. And I did that for 3 different years. And, you know,
it's the whole thing of getting something out and then improving on it, rather than trying to make the perfect thing and never reaching it because you're never actually shipping it, so nobody can actually see it. It's like you have to ship something before you can improve on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to make something so that the thing after that's better. You always look at it's the same way, you know, artists always look at their old sketchbooks and they're like cringing. You know, writers always look at their first novels and they cringe, and game developers always look at their old games and they're like, oh my god, I shipped that. Oh! You gag a little bit, right?
Yeah.
But that's part of it. You always go forward and you learn and you don't make those same mistakes again. And you just, you know, just got to keep doing it. But if you don't ship a game, you can't ship a game.
You're missing a vital part of the whole experience of actually shipping
a
game.
There's this deceptive thing where it's, you have a dream. I want to do X.
Yeah.
And I still have some dreams like that I haven't really pursued. You know, one is to actually record an album, an entire album. This is just music, not for a game.
Right.
You know, and I'm working on it. But it's something I'm kind of keeping at a distance because I like it as a dream.
Sure.
Right. You know,
and the further, the closer I get to it, the harder it gets. It's like, oh,
the more spoiled your dream gets because it's so much work.
You know? Well, yeah, you
know, I didn't expect this in my dream.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's something where it's like I have a bunch of songs. I really like some of them, and I'm starting to work on lyrics. I'm like, I don't know if I want to sing this or if I need to find somebody else to sing. And all these sort of questions come up, and it's like,
yeah,
it becomes more real and difficult. And if I was super dedicated, I could probably push through that and get to something, you know. But that's sort of the key to it, is like, are you going to actually push through it, or are you going to wake up and you're 50 and you're like, oh yeah, I still have this thing lying around that I never did anything with.
Yeah.
You know, and how are you going to feel about that?
Yeah, and there's a couple, I think there's a couple of fears that play into it. There's like, a lot of people suffer from the fear of failure, where if you never ship it, it's never going to fail.
Yeah.
But I think for me, and I found this when I got the job at Relic, like, I've been a Relic fanboy since Homeworld 1, so being a producer on Company of Heroes, opposing friends, it was like this lifelong dream come true. And I had no dreams after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I suddenly had no goals. And it took me a long time to realize, you know what, and I had to tell myself, if I had all the money in the world, what would I do all day?
Exactly.
I would just make games. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
And I would go in and I would make them myself. I wouldn't manage a team of it. I would go in and I would just muck about and make games. And that's just what I would do. I would get bored otherwise. And so I said, okay, well, that's what my dream has to be. And I could look towards other things. So then, even though, you know, Relic was the best job I ever had, I took a job out east in PEI because it paid me way more money and the cost of living was way lower, so I could start saving up and build, you know, a runway to go indie. And because my goal had changed, because I'd achieved that dream.
Yeah.
But yeah, that once Company of Heroes Opposing Fronts shipped, I was completely lost. Because I had this huge dream and I'd achieved it. I made, you know, this great.
This is reminds me of a quote that I saw recently. It's from Noel Coward, who was an entertainer, British entertainer guy. Pretty creative guy. But he said, "Work is more fun than fun."
Yeah.
And that's sort of a recurring theme on these podcasts when I talk to people, is they just love their work.
Yeah.
That's what motivates them. It's not, they're not like, okay, if I finally get this stupid game done, I can like make this money and then I can go on this vacation.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
And that's
very
the,
true.
That's the thing that I think is key to people who are starting out in some ways, like, you really have to love the work.
It's live, it's live to work, not work to live, or something.
Yeah.
That,
well, you always have to, you have to want to make games more than play them.
Hell's
you know, it's like, if you would rather play a game than make a game, and do that regularly, then you probably shouldn't be making games. And especially not going indie. Because
making games are very different than playing.
Yeah.
Very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Most people
I love
confuse the two, but
yeah,
it's especially aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
Oh, so you play all games all day.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I actually tell people I just type all day, and they go, "Oh, okay."
Then they're all
I understand
rude.
That. I'm like, really?
Actually, I have a funny story, like a quick anecdote. I was working on a McDonald's commercial, and you make a lot of money in McDonald's commercials. And the trick is, our Jenny operator, like, if anyone came up, to, "Hey, what are you guys shooting?" And he would always say, "Oh, it's a mayonnaise commercial." Because everyone would always be like, "Oh," and they'd leave. So that was his whole, like, sorry,
nice,
whatever. We're mayonnaise commercial, really boring, don't worry about it. Except one day, he pulls this thing with this old guy. He's like, "Mayonnaise commercial." He's like, "Whoa, really? This is a mayonnaise commercial?" It was the exact opposite of what he wanted.
Right.
Which was pretty good, because he couldn't get rid of the old guy at that point, because he's all intrigued that, well, what is the mayonnaise going to come out of a vat and go on the lawn? Like, he was like, I'm like, damn, I'm the only big fan of mayonnaise TV related stuff. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta love making, and you gotta be ready to fail.
Yeah.
Because you're gonna fail way more times.
You also gotta not care about failing.
Yeah, you can't give a crap about it.
Even though
that's really
hard.
That is really difficult, and that sort of ties into what we're talking about with Mike and Greg, where I was talking to Greg, and he's like, they were all up for doing a podcast. I'm like, okay, we should do it while we're still here, and like, while the game's still up in the charts and everything. And then Greg was like, oh, I just can't do it, and there's all these personal things going on.
Yeah.
It's just, there's that whole emotional cost that, you know, people on the outside don't see that. Even we're not really, like, until I talk, like, I was sort of aware of it, but until I talked to him, I didn't really get how serious it was, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, on the Penny Arcade article, you read the comments.
Yeah,
goes,
look at that.
You're an idiot, obviously.
The boneheads,
yeah.
Boneheads,
and
all that.
I know, and it's
yeah.
Like, it's like, I know they're reading those comments.
Yeah, it's
and
yeah.
I know
it's
that they're, that they can see that, yeah, okay, we've made a mistake in this case.
Yeah, that's,
yeah, but you know what the thing is like, if you're actually developing a game, I can kind of see their side of things too, where it's like,
mm-hmm.
if you're actually developing a game, you know, trees through the forest, right? Like, it's, it
mm-hmm.
is so hard to tell whether your game is good or not, whether
yeah.
you're in a good spot, and then you put it out there and everybody, it's like, everybody just goes, oh, that was stupid.
Yeah.
Well,
obviously.
Yeah.
And you're so
it
close to a
that,
project.
Yeah,
obvious,
it's like,
yeah. make your own game
it's
and
like,
try, you know? It's
yeah.
like...
Your heart, you're
yeah.
opening your chest. Like, if someone says, this Shellraiser art is crap, that is someone taking a dump on my heart. And I, like, I feel it, and it's like, man, did I fuck up. I feel so bad about it.
Oh.
And I was talking to Dan Paladin about this with Behemoth, and when people had problems with Castle Crashers, and they send hate emails, there's no buffer.
Yeah,
these are indie
like,
guys.
Yeah, they don't go
they,
to the
like,
PR departments.
They, yeah, they click their email and it's like, "Hey assholes,
yeah.
I'm mad at you and your shitty game." And it's like, "Wow, that's a sledgehammer blow. What's the next one? Holy, oh wow, this is too."
And then the flip side of that is,
you
know,
you
like,
get
I don't get any emails like that anymore. I think I got like maybe a couple.
Yeah,
sure. But see, you actually probably remember them verbatim.
No, I
maybe not.
I don't remember much of the negative stuff. Like I remember. The one comment I remember was on YouTube and was like, "This looks like a good game for women and fags." it was more just
always delivers YouTube comments.
Yeah.
Always delivers.
It was more just kind of hilarious
that is
like, but I still get these long emails from people who just discovered the game the other day, and they're like, "I just love this."
That's
yeah.
cool.
And I have to tell you how much I love it.
Well, it's just the fact
which
that people
crazy.
Actually go out of their way to tell you that. That
well,
is cool.
It's interesting because I think the threshold at a certain point, when something is old enough, it's like the threshold for wanting to express your love is lower than the threshold for wanting to express your hate.
Yeah,
yeah,
because,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
nobody, like if you're a troll, nobody cares anymore. You know, like games old
sure,
enough.
Actually, I have a good anecdote about that. Because when we shipped Shellraiser, there was a dude that reviewed our game and said, meh, in
yeah.
the title, and then said, shitty game or something.
Yeah.
1 star. And then I was like,
that's a pretty shitty
what?
Review. I give that review 1 star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, shitty game. Okay, that tells us nothing.
Yeah.
Which is a problem in the first place, because you're like, okay, you can just type whatever. And I was like, oh, that's kind of shitty. I don't know, whatever. But then a day later, he updated his comment and made it 4 stars and said, pretty addicting, actually.
That's like,
I didn't know you were
user. Oh, I didn't
know
either.
I'm
user.
I'm sitting
yeah.
here thinking it was a shitty game.
Yeah.
This is, okay, that's
yeah, nice. No, it changed his review, and I was like, okay, that's cool.
That's
I like that.
Cool.
Like, you know, I'm fine with people not liking our game. Like, if you don't like the game, cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, voicing it online... To me, like, personally, if I don't like a game, I just go whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not going
to
go to
the
effort.
Threshold to comment on it...
It's very low.
You have to be passionate
about your hatred.
I
think
you have to be, but
yeah.
some people seem to not have to be passionate
they just
at
like
all.
It.
They just go, whatever.
Whatever, I'll just
right?
create an account
yeah.
and then create a new
yeah.
thing and then
well,
type my comments.
So the funny thing is, like, Flash games, right? Because they're all free.
Oh, my
like,
God.
The comments go crazy. So my first indie game was a Flash game called Ray Art and the Science Ninja. And it's like this... pulpy sense of humor. You're like, he screams science and runs around and jumps on dinosaurs. Like, it's as absurd as it can get. And my favorite review of all time was 1 star. This game contains no real science.
that is the best review.
That is the best review.
Well,
that's good. Like, nothing else. Like, I was like, all right. I'm not reading the reviews anymore. I think I like checked reviews like
yeah.
twice after that, and if somebody had a problem, I would check it out. But
it is that is interesting too, because like, I think in the mainstream industry, I don't know how you deal with reviews, but I've talked to a couple people and seen, like, they don't seem to really look at it in the same way as when you're indie, and it's and like you're saying, you're ripping your chest open
yeah,
and people
yeah.
are shitting on it. You know, it's a bit
your
different.
It's your
baby.
Your
but then also
project.
At a certain point, when you've been exposed to enough of that hate and death threats
sure.
and things.
Yeah.
It's like,
death threats?
I got a couple death threats.
That is
really?
Horrible. You poor.
Some people really fucking hate
you.
It wasn't the kind of death threat where, like, I'm going to come and kill you, but the kind of, like, you don't, you know, deserve to live.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
For Aquaria?
Yeah.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, okay, I don't know why,
that is stunning.
Some dudes really had a bad Little Mermaid experience when they were young.
No, that I find absolutely stunning. That is insane worthy.
Yeah. I've heard of the same thing happening to a lot of other people. You know,
really?
I don't want to ruin anything by saying who it was, but I had a friend actually break down and cry over things related to that. It's all shit where people read things a certain way. They think people are privileged that they got into a certain whatever, that their project is doing well, and they're really just upset. And they vent in a really retarded way, and probably in most cases they don't mean it, but like it does happen, and
that is really crazy.
It's really fucked up.
Yeah, it's like there's this weird cult of celebrity, and I got it when I did the BMX stuff because I went from idolizing all the BMXers on the TV and in the magazines to going to all the contests and filming them and hanging out with them and sponsoring them and stuff, and I realized that everyone is just people, you know, and. So that person who made successful game X or film Y, they are just as human as I am.
Yeah.
And I should treat them as if I would... Like, the fact that they're celebrity or famous or popular or whatever doesn't matter.
The thing is, that's such an encouraging thing, too. Like, it's like, oh, well, then I could probably do something like that.
Yeah.
Like, sure, they had some luck, and then they also worked really hard. Well, maybe if I work hard enough, I'll find the luck, and somehow this will work out, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just so frustrating to be on Twitter, like... And see people complaining constantly about whatever it is, you know, and it's just like, well, you know, the person over here deals with the same shit you do, but they thought around it somehow.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't on Twitter complaining about it constantly. They were working on it, and they figured it out, you know? And
they got past it.
Past it, so...
I'm just still a little flabbergasted that you got those kind of...
Yeah,
well, the thing is, like, I don't know how serious it is. Right?
Well, probably not very.
Yeah.
You're still here.
Yeah. That's right. There. You made it.
Yeah. No,
and
it's probably
like just
well,
the shock.
Okay, yeah, right there. There's a laser. There's a laser line.
<It's
more laughs>
To compare, though, like, I remember when I was working on some projects at Relic where, you know, people go on the forums and all they do is vent.
Right.
And they vent in a mean way.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Mean.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, really, you're reading the email and you're like, really? Like, you felt that intimate about what. And it really just means they care. They care about what they're playing. They really want it to be good. And then you reply to them and you go, okay, well, your complaint about this is because it, you know, here's the reason, right? Like, this is why. Because it isn't as simple as you think.
Yeah.
And, you know, you explain the situation and then suddenly they reply and go, like, oh my god! That is so awesome.
Yeah.
You replied right away.
Yeah.
I respect you guys so much.
It?
And it's like, it's so...
I always want to punch people
when that
happens. It's bipolar. Yeah, I know. I just, like, it's nice when that happens, but it's also like, well, fuck you. Like, I get customer support stuff. It's like, where the fuck is this? Like, you're supposed to be here. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, I don't know, but we'll check into it. Oh, well, I love you. You're so wonderful.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, you have to read into emails. Like, emails are not, like... Emails are actually really bad at communicating.
Well, any kind of
online
text-based
thing.
Which is
all
online.
You have to take
all
that stuff with a... Well, I try to. It's hard sometimes, but you try to, like, just take it with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And try and help people.
Yeah.
Like, and if they have a legitimate problem, well, it might actually be a bug that
you
I
have
put
to,
in.
You have to ignore the trimmings and the dressing that they put on everything.
You have to
decode.
You have to
shave
off emotion and say with the facts,
exactly.
Right?
And then stuff doesn't really get you riled up as much.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems to affect the positive stuff, too, where it's still nice to receive those, but it's kind of a double-edged sword where you're like, yeah, they like it, but they might not really like it in the way that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I'm happy that they enjoyed it. But, you know, I don't want to actually go and investigate and find out exactly... You
I
know,
actually like getting emails from people that actually go, hey, you know what, I really like this because of that. And I was like, you know what, that's cool.
No,
somebody
it's awesome.
Actually
I
went,
love that
yeah,
stuff.
I think
I love
really
when
neat.
It's not what I expected, too. It's
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I really love this, and I'm like, I didn't think that would resonate with people, but it did.
Like,
and we've had a few comments, actually, on Shelters as well, where somebody's like, you know what, I really love your game, and, you know, blah, 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 and it's really cool, and I would really love to see this.
Text, yeah.
And it's like, you know what, that's actually a good idea. And it totally fits with the entire game. So we're probably going to put that in an update real soon, right? Like, and it's neat. Like, that's cool.
My favorite thing about Shellraiser is it actually became a game that parents play with their kids, and that made me so happy. It's like, my buddy was at Slant 6 right now. His pal's like, hey, I bought this game, Shellraiser. And me and my son played it all the time. I'm like, that is the coolest shit ever. Yeah. That is so cool.
Yeah. I love committing genocide with my child. I love that. Let's just invade their territory and kill them all. Yeah, it is
cool. Nothing better than that.
And it's funny because, like, the audio person, Jen, she was playing the game with some relatives of hers, and they were co-op playing. So each person would play a gun.
Oh, wow.
And so they had three people playing the game.
Stuff like that
and just, you know, something we hadn't even thought about at all.
Well, it's
really
that's
cool.
The most wonderful thing is watching people play.
Oh, once and they get it?
At a certain point, yeah.
It's the best.
Like, I was playtesting Robots Here with a bunch of high school kids.
Oh.
And that was actually pretty wonderful, because, like, at that point, I didn't have any idea if the game was any good or not. But, like, the kids just loved it. But you had the thing where, like, you had mid pairs of kids coming up, and in one case, they just decided, it was two girls, and one decided, well, I'm going to be the one to build the robot, and you're going to be the one to drive it. And that, to me,
that's
just,
the coolest ever.
That made me so excited,
yes.
Because I was like, oh, I could imagine being a kid and thinking, oh, I'm the builder, I'm the engineer, I've got this role, I'm going to do this, and you're going to do that, and then you're going to have to deal with what I do here, and it's just, it creates all these dynamics, but we didn't have to design anything for that.
Yeah.
It was just, they decided arbitrarily to separate
that.
That's
a less is more thing, too, though.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
It's just like, if they can build on to what you've done, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
It's like they've helped you with the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And now we have another awkward pause, which might be...
Dan.
Because now we are going at 3 hours, 22 minutes.
Whenever you look at your laptop, I'm wondering if you're checking if your SSD is full.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Nick's wine cabinet, actually.
See, well, we have way more wine. We could keep going for 8 hours.
That'll be the podcast no one listened to.
Yeah.
That's
what everyone says by this point in the podcast. There's like, no one's going to listen to this.
Yeah,
I'm like, wow.
I listen to them all.
Shane will.
Shane will listen.
You may take 8 sessions to make it through an episode. But
yeah.
Nice.
Who am I listening to? Right, it's still the call-in interview. Cool.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think it's a good place to keep it.
Cool.
Thank you so much, Alec. Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nick, for providing watermelon.
wine and watermelon
as well.
You're totally welcome.
And creating water.
And creating water. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I use that every day.
I create water when I was in there.